Fight Night Picks fans, how are you? I've never addressed a show this way on the podcast, but I'm very, very glad that you're able to check out the audio version of the show. You know, sometimes this is one that can get neglected, and as you well know, this is where the show started. I mean, it was me talking into a microphone about fighters and fights that nobody seemed to care about, and now we've gotten to this point, and it's all thanks to you folks. So I just want to reach out to everybody that's been patient with us here the last couple of weeks. I know I've been away, so we filmed a few shows here remotely. Question Mark Kicks last weekend, the full card previews this weekend. But again, yeah, I just really wanted to reach out on the audio version of the show. Thank you so much for everybody that rates, reviews, that leaves comments. It really does help drive the show. And I know a lot of different shows say that, but really, I mean, we wouldn't have been able to make it here without the folks out there. And I mean, back when we started in 2018, it was the audio version. It was the website. We got into some radio shows and doing some neat stuff over there. And it wasn't until the summer of 2019 when Matt and I kind of linked up and started to do the picks and the predictions. So I'm really looking forward to it. You guys have a heck of a card coming up this week, obviously, with Curtis Blaydes taking on Mr. Tom Aspinall in that main event. So many good fights to go all the way down through it. I know there's some picks, some previews that a few people are, you know, finding a little bit contentious. So I think it's going to be a really good week. Hopefully you folks out there enjoy your week, whether you're in the car, you're at home, you're walking the dog, you're on a plane. Hopefully it's a good week for you guys. And don't forget, Question Mark Kicks this week, it's going to be a very, very early episode because, again, for you fans in North America, this one's taking place in London. So don't forget, that's going to be an early start, and we're always live 2 hours before the prelims. So again, thank you so much for checking out the show. I hope you enjoy it this week. And as we always say, let's get into it.
Ladies and gentlemen, recorded in Fredericton, New Brunswick, Canada, it's time for Fight Night Picks with your hosts, Frank and Matt Allen.
And a welcome back with Fight Night Picks. As always, one half of the team, Craig Allen. You can find me on Twitter and Instagram at Craig Allen FNP. With me to my virtual left, to your virtual right, Matt Allen, respective socialist at Matt Allen FNP. Now, Matt, listen, we're doing this one remotely. Do people like the remote shows? Not necessarily, but listen, that's just a part of the world that we live in. I'm traveling once more. I've been away for 3 weeks out of the month, but nobody ever knows that. They never know that, but that is the grind with Fight Night Picks. And Matt, I have to say this before we go too far into the show. These have probably been the best 3 weeks we've had at Fight Night Picks in like a meaningful amount of time. Like, we've been firing on all cylinders here. You beat me last week. You beat me 2 weeks ago. I beat you last week. It doesn't matter. It's the team success. You might see those totals there. This is a team of Fight Night Picks, and we're having a damn good time.
Craig only says that when he's behind.
No, I don't. Joshua Hart doing the damn thing over on the website at fightnightpicks.com. But Matt, we parlay last weekend where there were a lot of underdogs that were able to get wins into this weekend. And I had a peek. Listen, I don't write down the odds, but I had a peek at the odds this week. And there's a lot of fights that are really skewed. And that really did surprise me because we look at a card that's coming up headlined by Blaydes, Aspinall. And if you focus on it, this is the second fight night from London at the O2 this year. The first one was in March. You had Tom Aspinall finishing Alexander Volkov, a tough, durable vet, very, very quickly able to implement the wrestling and the jiu-jitsu that he's known for. But if you look at this, I mean, the O2 has a long tradition of having big fights. And the first card that was at the London O2 was UFC 75, champion versus champion. It was the Pride middleweight champion, Dan Henderson, taking on your UFC light heavyweight champ, Rampage Jackson, the former Pride guy. So they always stack these cards. The fans always show up, and you have a lot of fighters in carryover from that last card in March to the card that we have coming up this week. And so I know you're really excited about this card. What can we look forward to?
Here's the thing. We call out the UFC when they put together some less than spectacular cards. I think that's fair to say. Isn't it wild? And this is going to get lost in the shuffle, but hopefully you could appreciate this. This fight card got thrown together in what, a month and a half? And it's a great fight night card. Like, it's one of those things that no one's ever really going to remember, but it felt like within 3 weeks it goes from, okay, we're just at the apex. We're at the apex. It's at the apex. And next thing you know, Curtis Blaydes going to be fighting Tom Aspinall. And there's 13 other really fun fights going down in London. So I really do think this is a great card coming up. And we were both saying this about the ABC card last weekend, how this is one of those, it's so good of a fight night. It could be like a borderline pay-per-view. This doesn't necessarily have the top tier talent, I would say, that last weekend's card did in Ortega and Yair, because I do think those guys are like borderline pound for pound guys. But Blaydes Aspinall is another great test for who could end up being England's best fighter in Tom Aspinall. I do like how they've been building him in the UFC. He got some, let's be honest, some easier fights to start out, but he slowly worked his way up, and fighting Curtis Blaydes in a 5-round main event is no easy task. We've seen Curtis Blaydes beat some of the best, lose to some of the best, but we know that at the end of the day, Curtis Blaydes himself is one of the best heavyweights in the world. So I am very excited for this main event.
Big time opportunity for both those guys. The co-main event, Jack Hermanson taking on a short notice replacement in the Action Man, Chris Curtis, who just got a big time win over Rodolfo Vieira just a few weeks ago. He accepts that one on short notice, replaces Darren Till. And of course, the fight before that, couple of weird social media personalities. You've got Paddy Pimblett, the baddie, taking on Jordan Leavitt. Everybody loves his twerking. Matt, let's throw it on over to the Fight Night Picks Fight of the Night screen. A little bit of a peek in on that one, but I want to hear from the fans down below in the comment section. Let us know who you have as a possible fight of the night, because listen, this is a big time card, 14 total fights, the short notice add in of Mason Jones and Ludvik Klein, Slovakia's own, in the feature prelims spout. So it should be a great opportunity for those guys. But again, that fight of the night screen.
Let us know down below in the comment section who you've got. It's time for the fight of the night with Fight Night Picks.
When it comes to a possible fight of the night, I mean, listen, Paddy Pimblett taking on Jordan Leavitt, and you focus in on these two fighters, very similar in the way that they're able to adjust in their fights and really go after the threat of the submission. You look at a guy in Jordan Leavitt, he was able to really surprise people with that big-time slam win over Matt Wyman, where Wyman's going from smiling to emotionless. And when you do look at it for Paddy Pimblett, he's had some opportunities in the UFC. He's been rocked in the opportunities, and he's come back and looked very, very strong in those fights. So I absolutely love this one. Obviously, Paddy Pimblett is a huge draw across the pond. But when you look at it for Liverpool's own, you focus in on him, you focus in on Molly McCann. Barstool Sports is lining up at the bank with duffel bags of cash. They're absolutely loving this card and thanking Dana White and, listen, Hunter Campbell, whoever put these things together. But Matt, when I do look at this fight between Leavitt and between Paddy Pimblett, I think this is great matchmaking and a good opportunity for both guys to build their star.
100%. And Jordan Leavitt's not supposed to get a fight like this. Let's be honest. Like, he's another prospect who's a dangerous fight, who isn't the sellable personality that Paddy Pimblett is. So if you're the UFC, why are you giving Jordan Leavitt this opportunity? Because other than the hardcores, I don't really think a lot of people realize how tough of a fight this is for Paddy Pimblett. Like you said, he faces adversity in his UFC fights, he being Paddy Pimblett, but he does always come out on the victorious end, and he's winning by dominant stoppages when he is able to get the win. So I think this is an incredible dangerous fight for who could be sort of the next cash cow on the horizon in Paddy Pimblett. But that's the thing. If he does beat Jordan Leavitt, that's a huge win for people like you and me, I think. Like, it's going to completely, maybe not completely change my opinion of Paddy Pimblett going forward. That's a bit of an exaggeration, but it'll definitely make me reconsider some of the things that are possible with him in this lightweight division.
And you look at the fight, I mean, for Jordan Leavitt, a budding YouTube channel where he discusses the books that he's read. And for Jordan Leavitt, not a guy that goes over 200 pounds during the off season. So good opportunity for both these guys. When we focus in on a second choice for fight of the night, that sneaky co-main event, I mean, I would have loved to have seen Darren Till and Jack Hermanson go at it. Obviously, with Darren Till, it's always the threat of the jiu-jitsu and the lucha libre that everybody kind of talks about in the periphery. But you know, Darren Till for striking, that elbow he was able to land on Robert Whittaker that wobbled him backwards. You look at Darren Till's skill set, and it matches up and complements Jack Hermanson so well. But with Till out on short notice, you focus in on Chris Curtis. And for the Action Man, I mean, listen, if it's Phil Haas, if it's Brennan Allen, if it's Rodolfo Vieira, these are all names that the UFC fan knows, coupled with the fact that Chris Curtis wasn't able to get that contract on his opportunity on Dana White's Contender Series, toiled away with XMMA, with PFL, and he's really put in his dues. I mean, this is a guy at 35 years of age that's really blossoming into a contender that isn't even in his weight class. This guy's a welterweight, and he's really putting on great fights at middleweight. Maybe that is the future, but Matt, I absolutely love this pairing. I think it's going to be a great fight.
And the great thing about Chris Curtis is that, maybe not for you, but at least for me, he's probably on the lower end of the scale for how much I'm concerned about him taking this fight on short notice. Like, Chris Curtis, especially at middleweight, is just down to fight pretty much anybody. And you don't have to worry about him making these crazy, crazy weight cuts in his life. So I do think that Curtis coming in at 185 is going to fight at, let's say, 90% of his full potential, 95% of his full potential. I don't think we're going to see a diminished version of him whatsoever. And for Hermanson, this is it, probably, right? Like, he's had enough shots at the top guys so far. He hasn't necessarily been able to break through. Like, to me, his biggest wins over an older Jacare, David Branch, who, let's be honest, by the time he got to the UFC, wasn't really the same guy that he was in World Series of Fighting. So Jack Hermanson does really need this win, especially over a guy who is coming in on short notice, because a loss to Chris Curtis would be devastating for the Joker.
Yeah, a lot of people very down on Jack Hermanson in this matchup. And if you'll remember, he did lose in a fight of the night against Marvin Vettori not that long ago, picked up a win after that. And then it was the loss to Sean Strickland his last time out. But great opportunity for both of these guys. And if you look at it for a guy like Chris Curtis, he's got that big, big energy. He's really just firing on all cylinders. So I absolutely love it. Like I said, 14 fights to choose from. Let us know down below in the comment section who you have in that fight of the night screen. We love to get those comments rolling. And listen, don't forget about the YouTube community tab where we've already thrown it out there. The main event, the co-main event, we're going to be reading your comments and reacting during these videos here tonight. So, Matt, when we look at this card as a whole, in terms of your ranked fighters, you have Curtis Blaydes, you have Tom Aspinall, both ranked in the top 10 of this UFC heavyweight division. Jack Hermanson ranked 8th. Chris Curtis hanging around the periphery. You have Nikita Krylov also ranked, taking on former title challenger Alexander Gustafsson, who's on a 3-fight losing streak. And then to round it out, a couple of light heavyweight bangers. Paul Craig taking on Volkan Oezdemir, a man who has renewed his hair. Matt, I feel like if my side part ever
he's
starts
like Brian Urlacher. Brian Urlacher, bald his whole life, retires, gets a full head of hair.
Yeah, if this ever starts to go, I'm not shaving it. We're just gonna keep trying to hold on to the wisps as I age. But when we do look at this, I mean, there's a lot of really good prospects, a lot of fighters that I know we're very excited about. Obviously, the second time out for budding superstar Muhammad Makhachev. He competed at that last O2 card, beating former UFC flyweight Cody Durden. Going to be taking on the LFA defending flyweight champion Charles Johnson, one of the most interesting nicknames in MMA. It's Inner G, and I have a lot to say about Inner G. I think it's going to be a great fight there. And then again, the late addition, we have Mason Jones taking on Ludwig Klein. Originally, Ludwig was supposed to be taking on Ignacio Bahamondes at UFC 277 the next weekend. Bahamondes, it's been said out there, some visa issues. So ultimately, Klein gets to stick around in Europe because he does train at Spartacus Fight Gym close by. And he's going to be taking on Mason Jones, who now has to make the trip all the way from California over to London to take this fight. So I think it's going to be a lot of fun, Matt. A lot of matchups that we're really excited about. And a lot of fighters that you and I are very, very familiar with.
100%. And this is a card that does have something for everybody. Like you said, Alexander Gustafsson at one point was as big of a name as anybody in the UFC. Now the fact that he's just a guy on the main card is very surprising.
A Hall of Famer. An actual Hall of Famer.
And a deserving one. Like, he is responsible for one of the greatest fights of all time in the UFC. So it is a great card that has a lot of great European talent on it. That's the one good thing. I saw a lot of people. I was listening to Morning Combat. Shout out to Luke Thomas and Brian Campbell. But they were talking about how much of a shame it was that Brian Ortega versus Yair Rodriguez didn't happen in California or in Southern Texas, you know, a place that did have more of a, you know, a Spanish population who would have really appreciated that main event more. Good on the UFC for at least stacking their European cards with a lot of European talent, because you know that the fans at the O2 are going to get up for this fight. Like, this is going to be as loud as you'll ever hear the crowd.
Lot of big time fights. And listen, we can't thank everybody enough with the kind words, the comments down below. It means a lot to us. So keep commenting. Let us know who you have in these fights. You're not wrong until Saturday night. Then we get to figure out what the scoop is. But some big time fights, like I said, nonetheless, you're going to want to keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. And as we always say,
let's get it.
Matt, if Fight Night Picks fans don't know us very well, A, I used to start off every video by going, hey, Matt, or Matt, and then everybody used to start to comment that, and they didn't really like it, but I'm going to do it this way, because if you're not familiar with the program, You might not know that one of my guys is competing this weekend. It's Claudio Silva. And when I do look at this fight, I mean, we have a couple of my guys, really. We have a Danish guy who at one point drew with Darren Till back when that was a big deal. And my other guy, Claudio Silva, if you do look at it, from 2007 to 2019, he had one of the wildest runs in all of MMA. And when it's all said and done, it's going to be completely forgotten. He went on a 14-fight win streak. And if you know who I'm talking about, it's Claudio Silva. And I used to go on other podcasts. I used to be on other shows way back when. And I used to always talk about Claudio Silva and Leonardo Santos. Both those guys are on 2-fight losing streaks right now. And if you focus on it for Silva, I mean, he lost to James Krause a couple of years ago back in 2020. Just looked kind of flat. And then his last time out, he took on Court McGee and just looked kind of flat. Like, we just haven't been seeing the same Claudio Silva that we were used to. Now, for James Krause, he's ridden that wave of success of beating Claudio Silva off into the sunset. He hasn't competed since. And if you look at it for a guy like Nicholas Dalby, who I was always, I wouldn't say enamored with, but I was always intrigued by, because came into the UFC riding ahead of steam. He was a little bit older in his career. He had that draw with Darren Till. He wasn't successful. He went back to Cage Warriors, became the champ, and then he came in back into the UFC, and it's been a mixed bag. So if you do look at it, 1-2-1 in his first run. His second run back, it's 2-1 with a no contest. But it's just, it's been a weird road for him. I mean, I'd say for Dalby, his best win is probably the Daniel Rodriguez win, one that was very controversial in the court of public opinion, whether you thought that he won, whether you thought that he didn't. The no contest that's on his record is a knock him out, drag him out. Like, Nicholas Dalby's never really been finished all that well. And then Jesse Ronson comes in on short notice up a weight class and clubs him down to the mat and submits him. And then, you know, USADA becomes an issue and Jesse Ronson fights it. But when I do look at this, Matt, again, my guy Claudio Silva is going to be one of those guys that doesn't get remembered for what he's done in his career. And it's just a little bit of a shame that we're kind of going into this fight and it's all forgotten.
So I hope you appreciate this. Claudio Silva is your Eduardo Nunez for me. I loved Eduardo Nunez when he played for the New York Yankees. No one's ever going to remember him. I loved him. He was a great third baseman who played really hard. I think he made like one All-Star game later on. I think he even won the World Series with the Red Sox like near the end of his career. But like, Eduardo Nunez to me was like just a knock him down, drag him out kind of a baseball player that no one will ever remember. Look him up on Baseball Reference. I've never done it, but someone should. Here's the thing about this fight. We just don't know what version of either guy we're going to get. And I think that's completely fine to say, because you're right. Claudio Silva at one point was one of the most dangerous submission specialists in this division. He was one of those one hit, one kill jiu-jitsu kind of experts where it didn't matter if he was on top or on the bottom. There was a great chance that he could end up getting a submission and finishing really via anything. He had rear naked chokes, guillotines. It was a wide variety of submission finishes. But the problem is, he kind of got started, or at least more consistent later on in his UFC life. And that was really been the issue. Like, I remember the Danny Roberts win, how excited people were after that, because Hot Chocolate himself was a pretty good prospect at the time. And then, okay, he takes about 5 months up, beats Cole Williams. But was that really a step up after Danny Roberts? Not really. So for Claudio, he's never really had that one win to help him break through to sort of the main audience. Like Li Jingliang and Muslim Salikov, they were both this past weekend looking for a big win to help them break through and enter that kind of chaos in the top 15 of the welterweight division. Now, Li Jingliang was able to get a really nice finish, but he needed that win to really insert himself into the division's top rankings. And for Silva, he was just never really given that opportunity in his prime. And it was a shame, because at this point, he is a diminished version of what he was. And I do think that the fighter he once was could have been maybe even like a 10 to 15 guy in the rankings.
The worst part for Claudio Silva, I mean, he's been in the UFC since 2014, fought twice in 2014, once in 2018, twice in 2019, once in 20, and once in 21. 5-2 is the record. His best win, the split decision over Leon Edwards, wouldn't you say?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, name value-wise, that's the best one. And if you look at it, obviously, he's a Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu black belt to the nth degree. He trains an American Top Team. There's so many different guys that you can train with there to get ready for a fight like this. But I go down through it. He was originally booked in March of this year to take on Gunnar Nelson, and he backed out due to a knee injury. So you hate to see that. But my biggest sticking point with Claudio Silva, when you're a lights-out Jiu-Jitsu guy, and I noticed there were some people that were kind of upset with Brian Ortega. If he's so good at Jiu-Jitsu, why doesn't he take more people down? Well, if you get into a wizard and you dislocate your shoulder, then bad things can happen. But for Claudio Silva,
that was an armbar.
I just focused. Oh, that's enough. I just focused no, in. No, no. on his last couple of fights, Matt, because again, the two fight losing streak in 2020, 2021, and we haven't seen him compete this year, especially with that knee injury. But I look at it, his last two fights, 3 of 22 on his takedown attempts. Like, that's not that great. His striking percentage is bad. He's 85 out of 270. So that's good for 31.8%. Like, I look at this, James Krause beat him. All three judges scored a 30-27. When he took on Court McGee, he had 2 30-26s and 1 29-27. Like, this is really, really bad. He's a southpaw, which is great. And the UFC will throw up that graphic, like 60% of southpaws win their fights. Like, it means anything. He's a negative striker. He has below average striking. And then the other thing that he has, his takedown average per 15 minutes is 2.63 to the UFC average of 1.53, but it's 25% accuracy. So if he chases these takedowns and he doesn't get anything out of them, he gets tired and he loses. And that's what I've seen in his last two fights. Like, I'm a big Claudio Silva guy. Again, if you've never heard of me, I'm nothing, but I used to be on a lot of shows and I used to talk about Leonardo Santos and Claudio Silva with a lot of respect and a lot of reverence. And I feel like I've lost that touch a little bit, Matt. And we've only focused on Claudio Silva so far. My guy, Nicholas Dalby, is a fun, flashy striker from distance, but it's a lot of single shots and it's a lot of hit and miss and a pitter patter. And when it doesn't land, it leaves a lot to be desired.
And that's always been the issue with Nicholas Dalby. It's not that he isn't a skilled fighter. It's just, if you're a great volume striker, you could probably out-volume him. If you're a great power striker, eventually you're probably going to get to him at a certain point. That's kind of been his issue. Now, I do think he is the far more well-rounded guy in this matchup because, like you said, Silva is a negative striker, and he's really going to have to chase that takedown if he is going to want to have any form of success in this fight. But like you said, and I couldn't agree more, the fact that he has such low accuracy with his takedowns just leads to him getting more tired faster. And if that is the case in this fight, it's not that Nicholas Dalby puts a crazy pressure on an opponent, but I do think his accuracy with his strikes is going to be the difference in a lot of these rounds if Silva can't get him to the mat.
And I hate to interrupt, but that's the other thing. When you do look at Nicholas Dalby, he's not traditionally known as a guy who can stop many takedowns. I mean, I go back and I look at his kind of back and forth re-entry to the UFC against Alex Oliveira, and you go, ooh, like you got yourself in those bad positions. And I know for Oliveira, he was able to do that to Kevin Holland not that long ago. So again, you got to take it all with a grain of salt. But I do look at a guy like Nicholas Dalby, and I mean, listen, he got dropped against Darren Till. He got dropped against Zach Cummings. He got dropped by Peter Sabata. So again, Nicholas Dalby's a decent striker, but he's been a little chinny in the UFC. His takedown defense is a little bit of an issue. So my bottom line on this fight, I wrote down neither guys are Saints. Neither guys are 2022 title challengers. And then the other thing, my basketball reference number one. If you watch Question Mark Kicks last weekend, Matt, I threw this one out there. I thought it went over your head, but my guy Claudio Silva right now is watching Zach. It's like watching Zach Randolph when he played for the Sacramento Kings in 2017, 2018. It's like, Papa, what are we doing here? Like, you were such a god over with Memphis. He ended up getting his number retired after the fact, but like, why one more season? And I look at Claudio Silva like, why again? And what new are we going to see out of Claudio Silva? Is Dalby's takedown defense that bad? It's not great, but is it that bad to where Claudio Silva can kind of go out there and exploit it? That remains to be seen. But man, my guy Silva's really slowed down a lot.
Oh, he definitely has. And that's why he's a plus, what, 220, 225 in some places?
Let's talk about that. Nicholas Dalby open to minus 280, minus 269 right now. Silva plus 240, plus 216. I stay away from it just because, again, like Silva, pretty big underdog in that spot. So it is what it is. And if you do look at this fight and you want to compare notes and you want to compare and contrast, it's a surprise to us. It is to you over on Tapology, Matt. I'm going to set the over under on the votes. I'm going to say over under 75% Dalby. What do you say?
I'll say over.
You're going to say over? Oh boy. 1,092 votes, 89% Dalby, large majority, 85% by decision for the 11% that have Silva, 34% by decision, 45% by submission. And I'm not cheating. Again, we're always together when I do that, but I'm not cheating, but that is what it is. So again, large percentage of the fans have Dalby. I have Dalby again. I think he can pitter patter, pick it away at range. We talked about some of those closer fights. I mean, you look at the Tim Means loss. He rallied in the third round. I like to see that out of a guy. I know he's a little bit older. He's training out of Arte Suave. You're going to see another guy out of that gym on this card in the Bosnian Bomber, Demir Hadzevic. So I do like that. He's also cross training at Redline. And Matt knows Team Redline quite well because that's Akira Korasani's gym with, of course, Alina Landsberg, the Elbow Queen. So I like that for Nicholas Dalby. But again, great team around Claudio Silva. It's just a matter of, has he aged even more overnight, or is he going to be able to turn back the clock?
I really doubt it. He's not Bernard Hopkins. Like, I do think Claudio Silva, the sand's probably run out. Let's be honest. He is slow. He doesn't move all that well. He's not a great striker. He could get a takedown early and submit Nicholas Dalby, and I would not be like all that averse surprised. I'd be impressed. Don't get me wrong. But for Dalby, I just don't really know what a win over Claudio Silva really gets him at this stage of his career. You lose to Tim Means, which, let's be honest, if you lose to Tim Means, that normally puts you in like, hey, you're fighting a guy off contender series level. And okay, if you beat Claudio Silva, does that really mean that much for Dalby? So Dalby, if he does get the win, I do think he will be able to. It's a good get back on the horse, I guess, but I guess it just doesn't really mean that much to me in the grand scheme of things.
We're going to find out this weekend if Claudio Silva is like Zeebo after 1,000 games. What are we doing here? Or will it be the Danish man, the Danish man, the Danish demolition man? Will it be Nicholas Dalby able to get the win? Both of us going with Denmark's Dalby to get it done. Let us know down below in the comments section who you have. We have some big time fights. Paddy Pimblett, Jordan Levitt, Hermanson, Curtis, and in the main event, Curtis Blaydes taking on Tom Aspinall. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, and as we always say,
let's get in.
Coming up this weekend, a couple of flyweights looking to finally crack that win inside the UFC's octagon. We have Germany's Mandy Böhm. Matt, you got to pronounce that O umlaut. She's taking on Victoria Leonardo. And Matt, when I do look at this fight, I never talk about fights in this sense because you tend to get upset about it. It really doesn't have any bearing on anything. But when I do look at it over on Tapology, if you go through their fighter rankings at flyweight, both Sabina Mazdow and Pauliano Battaglio are both ranked higher than Mandy Böhm and Victoria Leonardo, and they're both on 3-fight losing streaks. So I do look at this one, Matt, and I scratch my head a little bit. Obviously, for Mandy Böhm, previously unbeaten coming into the UFC, she was 7-0 with an no contest. I looked at some of her fights and I went, geez, there's some glaring holes. There's some good things for sure, but there's some things that kind of give me pause. And she was a former TKO champ in La Belle Province du Québec. But when I do look at this one, she's taking on Victoria Leonardo, somebody who had a hard time kind of getting over the hump over with Invicta. And I go through all of the fighters that she's fought in the past. And obviously the names she's fought are far more than the names that Mandy Böhm has fought. I mean, you look at it, a head kick knockout loss to Aaron Blanchfield, the two losses to Miranda Maverick, pro and exhibition in the Phoenix Series Rising. But when I do look at it overall, I mean, I had so many notes pre-Böhm versus Lipsky. And then I went back and watched that fight. And Matt, Mandy Böhm got run over by Ariane Lipsky in that fight. Like, run over. Like, I wrote down my numbers. Dropped in the second round, dropped in the third round. And in the third round, when she got dropped, the announcers were like, yeah, she got knocked down in the first round too. Yeah, I remember that. She didn't get knocked down, but she got wobbled really hard in the first round. Got outstruck 87-36 in the significant strikes. So went 0-4 in her takedown attempts. All she did was throw pawing kicks and drop her hands to eat flush hooks to the chin with no defense at all. And I sound really harsh. Go back and watch that fight. It was so, so bad for Mandy Böhm to have a debut like that.
You're up 1-0 in basketball references, so I got to get one back. This fight's more Drew League than G League. Let's be honest.
Like, no, it's Big Three.
Big Three's terrible. You know my feelings on the Big Three. I don't give a flying fuck about the Big Three. I'm sorry. But for Victoria Leonardo, like, she needs a win. And you're right. She has fought a lot of good fighters. And we often say this, hey, if you're a really good fighter and you beat lesser levels of competition, you better run them over because it's not really going to prove anything to us if you do anything less. For Victoria Leonardo, she gets run over by anybody who's good in this division. And I know that sounds very harsh, but it has been the truth up until this point. Aaron Blanchfield, Manon Fiorot, and Melissa Gatto are head and shoulders above the rest of her competition. And let's be honest, Miranda Maverick beat the brakes off her too. Now, yes, all of those fighters are great fighters, but there's a hard case to make. Like, Victoria Leonardo may not have even won a single minute of any of those fights against any of those women.
I will say, Matt, I it really did surprise me with Melissa Gatto coming into the UFC. That was her debut. We expected
she lit her up on the feet.
hear me up. We expect this great jiu-jitsu player. And if you watch Gatto pre-UFC when she was taking on Carol Hossa, who's in the bantamweight division, she kept pulling guard and then Hossa went into guard and then got submitted. I was surprised that Leonardo had so much success with her wrestling in the first round of that fight to get into guard to at least try and land something. Now, she wasn't able to do a whole lot with it. And yes, she did get lit up on the feet. Ultimately, she broke her arm, which Jared Cannonier can get kicked by a kick and break his arm, but he can keep fighting. But Victoria Leonardo gets her arm broken that you can't see, and a doctor grabs it and has x-ray fingers and goes, no, it's broken. I know it's broken. I've never seen something like that, but kudos to x-ray doctor that was in the cage that night. But when I do look at it for Leonardo, she's pumping out the 1-2. She tries to push forward. When she gets backed up, she brings her hands down a little bit. And you see that. I mean, ever since the head kick knockout, Darren Blanchfield, she will bring her right arm up and she thinks about it. And it's a conscious thing. I've seen all the fights since she brings that arm up. It'll drift, but then she'll bring it right back up. But the trouble is, she's wary of all the different things that are going to be happening. And she comes out of a good camp. She obviously has great training partners. I know Andrea Lee is a major point of that. And her husband owns the gym. And they seem to have a great relationship. You can see that while they're in the corner together. But again, like, I'm watching some of these fights, Matt. I mean, the Menafioto fight was a mismatch. The fight against Melissa
was
Gatto.
It ever?
The fight against Melissa Gatto wasn't all that great. But again, like, in her two UFC fights, 123-60 are the strikes against her. So it's sadly, it hasn't been all that great for her.
I see that hand up by her side. And to quote Travis Scott, I get those goosebumps every time because you know that she does remember those head kick losses. And that's the crazy
just
thing.
One.
Well, Manofio Host smacked her with a head kick too before she knocked her out. That's what I mean. Like, the hand might be up, but you can't block kicks with one hand. Like, you have to do it with two. Mark Munoz versus Lyoto Machida taught us that way back when. And shout out to the OG Mark Munoz.
Jim Wars, Mark afraid, Munoz.
Yeah, a guy who's not afraid to let high schoolers box it out in the locker
allegedly
room.
Allegedly.
Hey, that's pretty cool. No, anyways, just a wild story. But that's the issue with this fight. Do you like the long-range attacks of Mandy Boom, or do you like what could be the slightly more consistent game of Victoria Leonardo if she is able to get on the inside? Because I don't really expect much grappling in this fight. If there is any, it's probably Leonardo going for the offensive takedown. But if she does go for the offensive takedown and she's not able to get it, that might be a chance for Boom to just land a couple strikes on the in-between to get up on the overall numbers. Because neither one of these fighters have UFC finishing power. I think that's something we can both agree to. So this fight is more than likely is going to go to decision. So it really is going to matter, okay, who can get their numbers up as high as possible by the end of this fight? You're almost going to have to judge this fight like it's an amateur boxing match in the Olympics.
I'm sitting here trying to digest this one. I mean, Matt, I got to be honest with the fans out there. I went back, you do the tape study, like I have written down for Mandy Boom. Joe Martinez called her a kung fu artist, so she's like Roy Nelson, but not. Good leg kicks, no defense, not great head movement, keeps her hands low post kick, but then tends to keep her hands low throughout most of the fight. And the other thing that I wrote down was in her fight against Greet Eckhout back with Bellator, hands low, poor defense in that fight as well. And her coach there was John Kavanaugh with SBG. Didn't see her at SBG for this camp. She wasn't at SBG for her last camp. So I wonder how things have changed, how things have progressed, because I haven't seen a giant amount of progression. The other thing with Mandy Byrne was over with Bellator, they had her matched up to take on Liz Carmouche, which would have been Carmouche's foray into Bellator. Champion Liz Carmouche.
We all know how that fight would have gone.
And in the UFC, they had her booked against Tyler Santos. Just, did she beat Valentina Shevchenko? I don't know. But again, these are the names that they booked her with. Now the fights fell out. But still, when I do look at this one, I have a hard time making a pick. I mean, the odds on the fight, Mandy Boom opened minus 185. She's minus 137 right now. Victoria Leonardo opened plus 160, plus 113. If we have a look at those pesky Tapology votes, Matt, surprise to us as they are to you. I'm going to say over under 65% Mandy Boom.
I'll say under.
1,084 votes, 81% Mandy Boom. 88% by decision for the 19% that have Leonardo, 73% by decision. Who are these people? Who are they?
I'm so confused. 810 people about are like, wow, I'll have what she's having. I
like those
imagine.
Dots above the O. They're fun.
It's just, oh, this isn't a great fight. I don't know if we've said that enough during this prediction video, but it's the honest truth. Like, this is a great card, but every great card is going to have some filler on it, and this just happens to be one of those fights. I'm going to pick Mandy Boom, and you know what? I can't believe I'm saying this. If that many other people are confident in her, then they must see something that I don't, because I think this fight is as down the middle as possible, if we're being completely honest, because neither one of these fighters does that much that really takes away from the other's game or adds to their own enough that, wow, I'm super blown away by any one aspect of their game. So I'm going to ever so slightly pick Monster Mandy, but there's no confidence in that pick whatsoever.
I'm going to say something. I said something last week and a lot of people missed it. And then they came into the comment section. They were upset. But I said, Machinal has a better overall game. I like his power. I like his jiu-jitsu. And I'm going to pick the way that I don't normally pick. I'm going to pick Sumit Erji. When I look at this fight, Victoria Leonardo has the offensive wrestling. She throws good 1-2. She'll throw a leg kick. Mandy Boom throws out a little bit more. She's got a good guard game off of her back with her jiu-jitsu. See, those are things that I don't like. But I'm saying them in this fight because I do like that out of Boom. The prodding kicks, Leonardo's somebody that tries to close distance a lot. If she's able to get through that and in boxing range, Mandy Boom is no boxer. So for me, I do like Boom in this one ever so slightly. But again, just pop popcorn. Like if you got a can of Pringles, maybe just grab your can of Pringles, walk the dog, do whatever you need to do.
Like, yeah, take whatever money you were going to bet on this fight and just buy better snacks for the fight night. You know, get a pizza from Papa John's instead.
Enjoy the fights. Both of us going with Germany's Mandy Boom to get the win. We have some big time fights left on this card, including Pimblett and Levitt, Hermanson and Curtis, and Blades versus Aspinall. You're going to want to keep locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say,
let's get into it.
Coming up this weekend, the Canadian Monster is back, and he's ready to get into some fight action. He's going to be taking on the former Cage Warriors lightweight he was defending champion in Jai Herbert, and this guy is the Black Country Banger. He's from Wolverhampton. He's a Wolves fan, and he is a fun fighter to watch, and he's going to be taking on Matt, a guy who was a champ in our neck of the woods, low these many years ago, with Elite One MMA in Moncton, New Brunswick. It's Kyle Nelson and Matt. When I look at this fight, Kyle Nelson has had the weirdest UFC career, I think, of any Canadian. And listen, like Shane Campbell had a weird one.
KJ Buller had a bad one.
KB Buller had a bad
KB,
one.
KB, sorry. And apologies.
Kyle Prepelik, hey, it was short. It was sweet. Like, see these Canadians that we're mentioning that you never knew or you knew for such a short period of time. But when I do look at it, like ever since he was on the roster to now, I almost forgot he was on the roster. I have to be completely honest with you. We don't have a lot of big-time Canadian prospects. TJ Laramie fizzled out like that. Like, you have Charles Jourdain that arguably could have beaten Shane Burgos. You have Gavin Tucker. But the list of big-time Canadians in the UFC is very short. So when we do look at Kyle Nelson, makes a short-notice UFC debut, replacing either John McDessie or Jesse Ronson and taking on Carlos Diego Fajeya at UFC 231. He loses that fight. He's lost to some good names in this division. He has. Billy Quarantillo was his last fight. He also had his, you know, if I'm going to make a Canadian reference, like Len Song Sunshine, you know, Canadian group. He stole that sunshine against Marco Polo Reyes, and he went absolutely wild. He gets a big win there. But by and large, 1-3 for Kyle Nelson in the UFC. Again, I was halfway surprised that he was still with the promotion. Again, respectfully, he just hasn't fought in a very long time. And you look at him, I mean, decent defensive wrestling, but not the greatest. Decent striker when it comes to it, but he has a negative 3.19 strike differential in four UFC fights. So
I hate that.
It hasn't been the very best. Now, he's training for this camp. He's been a longtime House of Champions guy. He's also been cross-training at Niagara Top Team. Obviously, you know them. You know, Aaron Jeffrey trains there. We've seen Jazz Divisius that's in the UFC. She's trained there a little bit. And a lot of people out of Quebec have even spent some time at Niagara Top Team. But when I do look at this one, I mean, for Jai Herbert, is this just a back on the horse fight? In his last fight, when he dropped Ilya Topuria and beat the brakes off him in the first round, only to drink from a fire hose in the second round. Like, is this the one that gets Jai back over the hump? Because if you do look at this fight, it is at 155, and Kyle Nelson's guy that's kind of floated between divisions at times, but he's more a featherweight to me, isn't he?
I was telling you this before we started filming. Like, I truly believe the head kick Jai Herbert landed on Ilya Topuria is the cleanest non-knockout shot we've ever seen in the UFC. I thought he was, like, completely unconscious. He just sat down, got up, and then he started brawling again. But the issue with Chai Herbert is that he is the definition of a glass cannon at this point of his career. And it's just the truth. He gets into crazy fights. He is very susceptible to being hit by big shots. And he doesn't always eat those big shots all that well. And Kyle Nelson is an interesting case. And it's funny. The first thing that you brought up about Kyle Nelson that was a positive was his wrestling defense. That's never a great thing to be known for initially when you're a UFC fighter, because that's not really something offensive that can go out there and win you rounds, win you moments, win you minutes in a fight that's really going to sway the judges in your favor. And the thing for Nelson is he's lost to really good fighters, but his win is over Polo Reyes, a guy who, if you remember him, he was a fun fighter, but he would just like throw wild overhands, get hit by wild overhands. And if he landed first, he'd win by knockout. And if you hit him first, he'd lose.
I was looking at Polo Reyes' record here recently because it did come up in a video that we had done here, not that long ago, and it will come up actually in this video. That was his third knockout loss in a row and his second knockout in about 3 months. He had just lost to Drew Dober, and then he went and fought Kyle Nelson, and that one was at featherweight. The fight against Drew Dober was at lightweight. So you had a guy that got knocked out 3 months prior, dropping down an extra 10 pounds to take on Kyle Nelson to try and get into a brawl and then get knocked out again.
Now, I will say this about Nelson. I would say his best win is probably the Kama Worthy win. That was before either guy was in the UFC. Again, at looking at it right now. Exactly. And Worthy, we all know his susceptibility to being knocked out at 145. But still, at the time, that was a really good win for Kyle Nelson. I just don't think this is a great fight for him against Chai Herbert. Because let's say they do get into a brawl in this fight. Well, Herbert's a lot faster on the feet. Yes, I worry about him taking a big shot, but the thing is, I'm going to worry about him taking a big shot in every single fight that he's in anyways. And since he's a lot faster than Kyle Nelson, I just think his shot's going to land before Nelson's does. Now, if Kyle does start to wrestle early, maybe he can start to chip away at the explosiveness of Jai Herbert, take away some of the sting on the end of his shots. But the thing is, Herbert proved that he's not just a pure boxer in his last performance. I forgot the head kick. He threw some other really good kicks in that Topuria fight too, to the leg into the body. And I do think that him at kicking range is going to cause Kyle Nelson a lot of trouble, because Nelson does try to plod forward almost like he's Justin Gaethje. But the problem is, you're not. You're Kyle Nelson. And sometimes he does try to get caught up into a brawl. And if he does end up in one of those with a guy like Jai Herbert, I know Herbert normally loses these types of fights against good prospects. I just don't think Kyle Nelson, on almost a 2-year layoff, is in the same level of a guy like Ilia Topuria.
I think Kyle Nelson, if you go over and look at him on Instagram, like, he is caught up. He's ready for the fight. Like I said, cross training between the two gyms, Niagara Top Team, you're going to get ready, especially with that wrestling influence there. And if you look at it for a guy like Jai Herbert, great boxing. And what I had written down, create distance. Like, I sound like I'm John Anik or one of the guys in the desk. Create distance, establish power shots and combination. When you watch him flow and when you watch him lead those long extension punches, he's not a guy like your guy Dricus Duplessis that's going to run across the cage and try and just blitz you, but he will plod forward, throw full extension at the end of his shots. And the trouble for him is, if he's going full extension, straight shots, and somebody catches him with a hook of a counter, that's it for Jai Herbert. Like, that's where the fight ends. If you look at it for Kyle Nelson, he's a grinder. He's good at clinch work. He's got poor accuracy, but he's got good takedown. So it's one of those ones. Can Kyle Nelson really try and expend that gas tank? Obviously, for Jai Herbert, training at Team Renegade BJJ. When I think of that gym, I automatically think of he is a Brit.
He said automatically, like Mike Francesca.
He trained... In Canada, it's Tom Breeze, a guy who trained at TriStar for a long time, but he's a Team Renegade BJJ guy. But when I look at the odds here, Jai Herbert opened -250, -281. He got knocked out 4 months ago at the last O2 show. Kyle Nelson opened +210, +226. Matt, we have a look at the Tapology bill. Surprise to us as they are to you. I'm going to say over under 70% Jai Herbert.
I'm going to say over, but I don't feel good about it.
Oh my gosh. 1,080 votes, 94% Herbert, 83% by knockout for the 6% that have Nelson, 54% by knockout.
That feels dirty.
I don't like Jai Herbert as in your 3-1 favorite in any UFC fight. And I certainly don't like over 90. Again, we sound like two guys that know nothing about the sport being surprised by these odds and also the fan votes. Again, I like Jai Herbert for what it's worth with striking. I'm not the biggest Kyle Nelson guy. just based on the fact that, yeah, he hasn't had a ton of success in the UFC. And if you look at it, the Paulo Reyes win is fun. It's a good fight to go back and watch. Matt Sales was able to get him down and submit him. Matt Sales, when he was on weight and in shape, was a fun fighter. But when he fought Jordan Leavitt, he wasn't. So I look at this fight as, yeah, Jai Herbert, it's one of those ones you'd think he's going to win. But boys, again, like almost 3-1 favorite, I stay away. Just like that old Alice in Chains song.
Oh, yeah. I don't love the odds at all. But here's the thing. I just need to get the fight right. I'm not putting any money on this. So I still think Jai Herbert's the far more skilled guy. And at the end of the day, that's kind of how you start to predict these fights. If Kyle Nelson is able to mix his martial arts to his fullest potential, then maybe he is able to wrestle box his way to a victory, fake the takedown, come up top with some big shots, maybe hurt Jai Herbert with a big punch, take him down, rinse and repeat, that kind of a game plan. I just don't think he wants to get into a firefight with a guy like Jai Herbert. And I do think that's what his style tends to be catered towards. So I'm going to pick Jai Herbert ever so slightly, even though I do agree with you. I do not like the odds where they're at.
Both of us going with Jai Herbert in this matchup. Let us know down below in the comment section if we shouldn't go against our fellow Canadian Kyle Nelson, or if we go with a member of the Commonwealth like we picked in Jai Herbert. It's a big time fight. We have some big time fights left. I mean, Curtis Blaydes taking on Tom Aspinall in the marquee main event. You're gonna want to keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, and as we always say,
let's get in.
Flyweight prospects squaring off coming up this weekend. We have Muhammad Makhachev looking to push his 30-fight undefeated streak going back to his amateur days, taking on Inner G Charles Johnson. Flyweight champ over with the LFA. And Matt, when I do look at this fight, I mean, I think this is so much fun. You look at it for Charles Johnson, a ton of experience pre-UFC, but if I back it up, I mean, Muhammad Makhachev is one of the hottest prospects in all of MMA, 23-0 as an amateur, two-time IMMAF world champion. He's a European champion. You look at it, I mean, he left a crazy life as a refugee out of Dagestan, moved to Wigan, started training at Team Calbon as a young kid. And I mean, he parlayed everything at the age of what, like 15 when he started his MMA career, all the way up to 21, just continues to win. He was a wrestling champion when he was in high school. He is now parlayed that again into the world of jiu-jitsu. Like, there's so many different aspects of his game, of just Muhammad Makhachev, and you can pick out individual fights and say, okay, he gained this in this fight, or he showed us an extra wrinkle in this fight. But when it all boils down to it, I mean, this guy is lightning quick, very precise with his takedowns. And when it comes to his striking, a little bit unorthodox, pretty low on his boxing, and pretty kick heavy when it comes to it. But what I absolutely love out of Muhammad Makhachev, I actually have a comparable, and I think it's a little bit of a reach, and it's not just because they're undefeated, but I think, geez, who's another guy in the lower weight classes that's a great wrestler and very kick heavy and doesn't like to box? It's Umar Nurmagomedov. And when I look at both of these guys, they do a lot of things similar, switching stances. I'd say Nurmagomedov is obviously more polished, even though he has less fights. But when I watch Muhammad Makhachev, this is a guy that I'm very, very excited about. And he's been training an American top team for this camp.
And that's a really exciting note, because Muhammad Makhachev is of that like SS tier prospect. And it's wild. You know, on the last pay-per-view, it was, okay, Adesanya fighting, he's the champion. But we kind of knew that two fights before the main event, we were going to get the winner of that being Sean Strickland and Alex Pereira. The winner of that fight was going to then fight the winner of the main event. And that's a really fun storyline to have. I have a very, 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 very strong feeling that Muhammad Makhachev is going to be a guy who is going to headline one of these cards eventually. I know that's a wild thing to say, but I genuinely do think he is of that ilk of a prospect. I know people are going to look more to like Paddy Pimblett in this card and think, wow, he is going to be that future superstar. But I've got to be honest, being only 6-0 in his professional career, and like you said, he has an extensive amateur MMA career, which we don't often see, if we're being completely honest. Like, amateur ranks and amateur fights are something that is definitely used to its fullest potential in the MMA world. It's probably just because, hey, you attain a lot of damage in this sport, so you probably don't want to burn yourself out on the regional scene as much as you do once you get up to the bigger shows. But for Makhachev, it feels like his regional experience has really molded him into a much more refined fighter than you would expect for being only 21 years old. And that's the crazy thing. You might look at a guy in Paddy Pimblett and think, okay, he has the higher ceiling, or he's better right now. But the thing is, he's 27. He's had 6 years to get better fighting great fighters. I really do think for where Muhammad Makhachev is in his career, he's much further along than the majority of 21-year-olds with six fights. I'm going to say this, and I'm not going to give him like, he's going to be a Shavkat Rakhmonov, but I think he's much closer to Rakhmonov than he is a Sage Northcutt, and I hope that's not a hot take.
No, and I mean, going down through it, Matt, like, we focus on him a lot, and there's going to be a lot of the focus this week on Muhammad Makhachev. It's not going to be the story about the guy who's from the States going over to the UK to try and get some fights, to try and get a win, but when I did look at Charles Johnson, this is one of the more interesting tape study dives that I've done in a little bit of time, because you look at it, I mean, former LFA flyweight champ, he won the belt in the main event of LFA 110. He was, the co-main event of LFA 100. You had Victor Altamirano in the main event. He's now in the UFC. He defended the belt at LFA 114 and again at LFA 122. And he won those fights by finish. Like, you like to see that. Now, he did win the belt by split decision, and I don't know if he really won. If Horiuchi didn't kick him in the nuts and lost a point early in that fight, I actually thought that Horiuchi won that fight even with the kick to the nuts, because it was a close fight. Horiuchi was kind of pressuring the action. If you only watch the fifth round, you're like, oh, Johnson definitely won that fight. But go back and watch the entirety, because it was a very close fight. I thought Horiuchi won. But overall, when you look at Charles Johnson and you just watch him fight, I think, geez, this guy's a really good wrestler. This guy's a really good kicker. And then I really went really, really deep. Like, he's 11-2. The two losses are to Brandon Royval in 2018, which is fair. And then a loss to Shorty Rock's Sean Santella back in also 2018. Those are two real deal 125ers. I know Shorty Rock's not in the UFC, but look at his friggin' record. He's been around. MMA fans know him. If you don't, get yourself familiar with him. But they mentioned in one of the LFA fights, like, this guy's a Golden Gloves boxer. So I thought, okay. So from 2017 to 2020, Charles Johnson had a boxing career, Matt, and it's the Kay Hansen boxing career. He went 1-5-4 as a pro boxer.
Yeah, this is the thing. Anyone can fight in Golden Gloves. Like, anybody can do it. It's just an amateur tournament. Being in Golden Gloves means nothing.
So I see all of that, and I go, okay. So he's an AAU national champion in track and field. He got a scholarship at the University of Arkansas, Pine Bluff. He's a two-time national champion in steeplechase at Southeastern Missouri State. So you know that the cardio is good, and obviously he's had all these five-round fights. Go on. His cardio is great. Like, he wrestles, he strikes, he turns it on as the fights go on, which might not help in a three-round atmosphere, but that's neither here nor there. But again, when I went back and I watched these fights, his last fight when he took on Moda, the fight was at home. He's a St. Louis guy. LFA's in St. Louis. He walked out to Dreams and Nightmares by Meek Mill. So, big 76ers fan. I like that. Weirdest rear hair flex I've ever seen. Like, he's got the salad in the back, but that's it. Like, he shaves his head and then leaves a little tuft in the back. I don't know what that's about. I don't really like it. But when I watch this one, I mean, Moda catches a kick. He takes Johnson down. I thought, ooh, that's bad. And that continued to happen throughout the fight. But I'm 3 minutes into round one, Matt, and I went, I'm sorry. So this Charles Johnson guy that I've been told is a Golden Gloves boxer. He's boxed pro. He's 1-5-4. I literally wrote down 3 minutes into round one, is he really a boxer? And then I went and watched the rest of his fights. He is no boxer. No boxer.
Yeah. I have no idea how he's going to have success against Muhammad Makhachev at range in this fight. Because here's the problem.
His kicks.
If Johnson throws kicks, though, he's immediately getting taken down. And it's going to happen over and over and over again. And Makhachev has the kind of pace to where if he does take you down in that first round, you're going to be exhausted trying to get back up. It's one of those smothering styles where he's going to keep on breaking your base down over and over and over again. And if Johnson isn't able to get Makhachev's respect at range with like a front kick out the middle, like, yeah, you're hit Brian Ortega with, like, he's going to have to hit him with something wild to get his respect early, because I really do think Makhachev's going to be allowed to have really constant forward pressure throughout this fight. And I think that's going to be his key to success, because I do like how he cuts the cage off for a guy who is only 21 years old. Again, he is very, he's experienced, but not really. And that's the thing. Again, he does have all that amateur experience, like we've said, but he is so young in his professional career that he fights like a much more experienced fighter than he probably should. And I do think that his cage cutting and his forward pressure is going to be the key to this fight, because if Johnson can't use his feet to evade Makhachev and his takedown attempts,
and his feet are great.
They are really good. But if he tries to make this a wrestling match as to like, hey, I'm a pretty good grappler too, he's going to get out grappled 10 times out of 10 in this matchup.
my big thing, Johnson moves a lot, and it's not a negative. It is not a negative. We say this a lot, like, oh, they move too much. Why do they move so much? They tire themselves out, or they end up walking into punches. Charles Johnson has really, really good striking defense, and it should be noted, 2019 Tiger Muay Thai scholarship winner, so you get to go over there, you get to train. In 2016, Mallory Martin was also a Tiger Muay Thai scholarship winner, so take it all with a grain of salt, but when it comes to his striking, I figured, okay, I did all this outside research. I'm expecting a boxer, and what do I get? A guy that throws a lot of teep kicks, a guy that throws a lot of leg kicks and head kicks and doesn't really throw much in combination until he tires out his opponent. And then you watch this guy box. And when he has his opponent tired and he pressures them up against the cage, he's ripping to the body and then coming up to the head. He really is a lot of fun to watch like that. Constant pressure, really putting things together. But again, he gets his kicks caught fair bit, and his takedown defense is a little bit questionable for a guy that I expected to have pretty good wrestling. So when I do look at the odds in this one, Matt, Muhammad Makhachev opened a -490 favorite, still roughly there, -485. If you look at it for Johnson, open +380, +360 or thereabouts. So Makhachev is a pretty big favorite. We have a look at the Tapology votes. Again, surprised us there to you, but I'm going to say over under 90% Makhachev.
I'll say over. I think it'll be like 98, one of those ones.
Yeah, 1,183 votes, 94% Makhachev, 27% by decision, 58% by submission for the 6% that have Johnson, 51% by decision, 39% by knockout. I go back and I watch that fight that Muhammad Makhachev had against Abdul Hussein out of Finland. I don't know why I said it Finland. That's yeah, like wow. that's like an American going, oh, you know that province in Canada, that Newfoundland. No, it's Newfoundland. But sorry, so for the Finnish people out there, I apologize, Finland. But when I do look at that fight against Abdul Hussein, he's one of my can't-miss prospects, even though he lost to Muhammad Makhachev. I think he's such a great fighter. I broke this down the last time we talked about Makhachev. So if you want to hear about Abdul Hussein, I talked about him in different shows too. But when Makhachev beat him, he broke him down and he just kept going and going and going and going. I like to see that against a well-seasoned guy like Abdul Hussein. I think Charles Johnson is a great test. I think he's an even better test than Cody Durden. So I'm really looking forward to this fight. You can't count Johnson out because he has that great cardio. Makhachev, if he overexpends himself early on, maybe he has to pay for it as the fight progresses. But for me, yeah, I have Muhammad Makhachev here. I think he's, with his kicks, the way that he breaks down all three levels, both guys do it similarly. I like the speed out of Makhachev, but the guy's relentless for those takedown attempts, and I think that's what's going to be able to win him the fight if he's able to get it done.
Yeah, I think Makhachev's going to win this fight unless we get like a weird Adriano Martins versus Islam Makhachev kind of knockout. Like,
it's
I really
MMA.
Don't... Exactly. It's MMA. There's 4-ounce gloves. Everybody's a knockout artist because of that. But again, I do think Makhachev is probably the best prospect on this whole entire card that features Paddy Pimblett and also the prospect himself, Nathaniel Wood. I know how much you hate that nickname. So I really do think he is one of the next big stars in the UFC. Only time will tell. I could be wrong. I've been wrong about this stuff before, but I'm really excited about this matchup.
Both of us going with a guy who featured Hasbulla over on his Instagram page not that long ago, Muhammad Makhachev, to get the win. Let us know down below in the comment section if you really like the former LFA flyweight champ making his UFC debut as Energy Charles Johnson. We got a big time card coming up, including that matchup that you mentioned. Paddy Pimblett, he's taking on Jordan Leavitt. You're not going to want to miss this. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say,
let's get into it.
Coming up this weekend, Jonathan Pierce, he's a grappler, he's a trendsetter, he's the bane of Matt Allen's existence, and he's going to be taking on 2022's European most interesting fighter in the world, number two behind, well, you guessed it, Askar Mazurov. It's Makhwan Amirkhani, and Matt, I know you have a lot to say about this fight.
If I may, Craig, you know how sometimes on these cards we like to say, hey, this is almost like Dana White gave us the power to put the fight together, and it's one of those fights that it's kind of our underground kings, if you will. This is the opposite of that. I would never put these two guys together. Exactly. Because here's the thing. You want to know who never gets a Jonathan Pierce or a Makhwan Amirkhani fight, right? It's your boy over here. So I can only imagine how wrong my prediction is going to be for this matchup. I'll give it back to you.
So, Matt, like I say, bane of your existence. And do I add 2022 Makhwan Amirkhani to that category? Because if you look at it, I mean, the whole is greater than the sum of the parts. That's an Aristotle quote. And when I look at Makhwan Amirkhani, is it just this year? Like, again, makes his UFC debut years and years ago, back in 2015 in January. And it's like, wow, this guy knocked out Andy Ogle in 8 seconds. Is he the most interesting man in the world? So Tapology changes his picture. And we all know what it looks like. I saw Clint threw it out there on Twitter, Diehard MMA Pod. And listen, it comes up every time we're in a Mach 1 Amerikani fight. But you look at it like he lost his last 3 fights going into his last one. He was 1-4 in his 5 on in. He was taking on Mike Grundy. It was at the O2. So this fight was 4 months ago, the last card that was over there in March. And Grundy had like... It's hard to address, but his father was, you know, his father was very sick and the commentary team focused on it. The cameras focused on it. Mike Grundy, you could tell, was amped up. Goes for a takedown attempt, runs into a submission, gets submitted in 57 seconds. And Mach 1 gets a performance bonus. And it's like, what? Where's this Mach 1 been? Because Mach 1 is a guy. And we talked about Mandy Broom, who's also on this card. She used to train out of SBG. She had all her success her last time out. She wasn't training there. She lost her UFC debut. Mach 1 was an SBG Ireland guy for the longest time. Opens up the MA Training Center, which is Mach 1's gym. Also trains kind of close to home in Finland as well. But when you do look at it, Matt, like I haven't seen giant leaps and bounds in Mach 1's game. The 3-fight losing streak, I thought, geez, like, is he on the back nine? You consider it too. Like, he's 7-5 in the UFC since 2015 when he had that 8-second win over Andy Ogle. And only one fighter that Mach 1's beaten out of those 7 is still in the UFC. Hasn't competed since Mach 1 beat him, and that's Danny Henry back in 2020. So for Mach 1, I too will say I have a hard time gauging him. And I say that Mike Grundy was released after he lost to Mach 1, so it's only Danny Henry that's left.
And it really feels like Mach 1 Amerikani has become a guy who other people build their name off of. Let's just call it what it is. Like Mach 1 Amerikani, you don't really think of as the prospect that he once was, because when he did have that...
Who's buying stock on Kamwella Kirk other than me?
Lerone Murphy got a pretty big bump after it. I know he hasn't fought since, but still, Lerone Murphy's a really good fighter. So I think that was probably the marquee win of his career. But still, Shane Burgos was somewhat unproven up until he beat the brakes off Amerikani. Arnold Allen had a close fight with him. I thought Arnold Allen won. It's an awful fight. I do not recommend going back and watching it. And I love Arnold Allen. Like, I thoroughly enjoy watching most of his fights, but boy, that one was terrible. The thing with Amerikani is, though, and you hit it right on the head, did we learn anything even though we beat Mike Grundy in a minute? Not at all. Mike Grundy put himself in a bad position and Amerikani took advantage of that. But guess what? You're an MMA fighter at the UFC level. I expect you to be able to do things like that. So for Amerikani, I still think more about the negatives that we saw in that 3-fight losing streak more than the positive win over Mike Grundy. Because like you said, Grundy himself wasn't necessarily the hottest show in town at the time. Like, he was also a guy who had experienced some losses in the UFC. Like, he wasn't really at the peak of his powers, if there ever was a peak of his powers, Mike Grundy. So I do think Amerikani still does need this win. It's a very important win for his career because Jonathan Pierce has gotten the bad taste out of most people's mouths that the Joe Lozon loss left, because I know I was very down on him. Everyone loves bringing it up, but the high Kamaka the third win was really nice. I don't think the highest of Kamaka the third, if I'm being honest, but still.
And I do.
Exactly, something we are allowed to disagree on. But the Omar Morales one was genuinely impressive. The way that he was able to avoid any big shots from him, he looked really good with his own wrestling, was able to take Morales down multiple times, and he had the killer instinct in that fight. But the problem for me is, and I don't know if I'm overthinking this, so I guess I'll hand it off to you after this. I don't like it when a guy gets a good win on his record and then almost takes a step back at his next win. Like, after you beat a guy like Omar Morales, you should be set up for something bigger. Fight a Jim Miller maybe near the end of his career. Fight an older cowboy. Like, get a matchup like that. The Christian Rodriguez win was a really nice win, but I don't think that that taught me anything that the Omar Morales performance didn't already do.
It taught me something negative. So I just want to go back and then I'll go forward. If you look at it for Mach 1, again, 7-5 in the UFC, tied for second all time in UFC featherweight history with submission wins. He has 4. Charles Oliveira has 6. But the thing about Mach 1, and this kind of goes to speak about Mr. Jonathan Pierce, 1.36 significant strikes thrown per minute to 2.41 absorbed for Mach 1. That's a negative 1.05. UFC average for and against is 3.38 per minute. So he's way below in terms of what he throws. He's below in terms of what he receives, but he doesn't strike a whole heck of a lot. He does tend to hold his hands low. He has the threat of the takedown. He is a tricky guy to try and figure out. And obviously he can be lights out on the ground. We do know this, but when I look at Jonathan Pierce, like, the loss to Joe Lozon, is it one of those ones? Like, to me, it's like Ricky Simon lost Uriah Faber, and I consider that an anomaly. I talked about that last week. I consider the Pierce loss to Lozon a little bit of a speed bump on the career. But to touch on what you said, you look at the three-fight win streak that Pierce has. In terms of takedowns, in terms of control time, like, Pierce was a state runner-up at Science Hill back in Tennessee. And, I mean, wow. I talk about this all the time because he used to wrestle below 125 pounds. Then he finally grew into his body. He went 5 of 7 on takedowns against Kai Kamaka III, 6 of 11 against Omar Morales. And he went 6 of 10 against Christian Rodriguez. Rodriguez stepped in on less than a week's notice for Austin Lingo back in February. So that's why you have Rodriguez, who moved up a weight class to take the fight. 11 minutes and 17 seconds of control time for Mr. JSP. But the trouble is, go back and watch that third round. Like, Christian Rodriguez had Jonathan Pierce in some really compromised places on the feet. And that leaves a lot to be desired because JSP wrestles like he's got cardio for days, but he's got like 10-minute cardio.
But you bring up the fact that Mike Grundy struggled in, or sorry, that Jonathan Pierce struggled in the third round of his last performance. Makwan Amirkhani, that's like the definition of his fighting style. It's, hey, if it's not growing great in the first round, then you're not going to like what it looks like in the third round. Like, he really does need to get off to a really good start in this fight, but the same thing does have to be said for both these athletes. So I really do think more than anything, and normally it's the other way around, it's, hey, whoever finishes the fight strongest is probably going to win. This fight, more than any, could come down to whoever wins the first round, because the last two might be so close that both these guys at 100% gas, that might be the only way that they're able to differentiate themselves in the eyes of the judges. So I really do think that the first offensive takedown landed for either guy is going to be a really important point in this fight, because if Jonathan Pierce is able to get on top of Amirkhani, he's going to be able to sap his energy even more than he normally would. But the same thing has to be said for Amirkhani. He likes to go for a very high volume of takedowns. What I don't love out of Amirkhani, though, is he doesn't have great top position. You can get up from under him if he's on top of you. You can buck at the hips. You can make separation. He's not lights out with his jiu-jitsu. He does have good submissions, but sometimes he will lose position going for, you know, a Darce choke over the top, or kind of a risky position that a more trained fighter and I know this is a bad example because he's the best, but like a Charles Oliveira doesn't make a mistake like that. Like, once he gets that first submission, that's the last submission because he locks it up. With Amirkhani, he does almost have a sloppiness to his game that does work out for him, but I do worry that if he's not able to get that first offensive takedown, he'll be the more tired of these two by the time that third round does come around.
You look at the odds for this fight, Amirkhani opened the underdog plus 160, plus 180 or thereabouts. And if you look at it for Pierce, open minus 185, minus 223 for JSP. Matt, we have a look at the Tapology votes, surprise to us as they are to you, as I get an Irish accent to surprise. I'm going to say over under 72.5% Pierce. He's the favorite in this one.
I'll say under.
It is under. So 1,088 total votes, 60% Pierce, 55% by decision, 32% by knockout for the 40% that have Amirkhani, 23% by decision, 67% have him to win by submission. So this is one of those ones, like, we both kind of touched on the same points. I like the high motor Jonathan Pierce, and I love how he looked against Kai Kamaka. I love how he looked against Omar Morales. I don't necessarily love how he looked against Christian Rodriguez, and I think Rodriguez is a good prospect at 135. I said that before the fight, so I can kind of go back on that forever. It's on the video. But Matt, when I do look at this one, for Amirkhani, he does have that much UFC experience. Obviously, he's been with the promotion for, 7 years now and 12 fights, so not a guy that competes all the time every other month, but he did pick up a performance bonus his last time in the O2, which was just back in March.
He did. I have a hard time picking Amirkhani, though, just because the win over Mike Grundy didn't mean that much to me in real time. And that's the thing that I do have to remind myself. Like, it's easy to think, oh, Amirkhani ended his losing streak. He righted some of the wrongs. But let's be honest. Mike Grundy rushed headfirst into a, like, rear naked choke, basically, and got finished. It wasn't a good performance whatsoever. And this fight is Anaconda. So weird. Sorry, it was an Anaconda. What did I say?
Rear naked, but regardless, go along.
Anyways, it was one of those performances where everything went wrong for Grundy more than everything went right for Amirkhani. So I do have a hard time having more confidence in him than I did before the losing streak. So ever so slightly, I will pick Jonathan Pierce, because I do think that if these two get into a prolonged wrestling exchange, Jonathan Pierce will be able to out-wrestle Amirkhani, at least for that first round. I do think that's how important the first 5 minutes are in this fight. I think whoever wins that first round is going to be able to set themselves up a lot better for 2 and 3 than the person who loses the first.
You're going to see how the weight cut goes for both these guys. For Pierce, a big-time opportunity to fight outside of those United States for Makwan Amirkhani. somewhat close to home in Europe. Both of us going with Jonathan Pierce in this matchup. I think Matt Pierce, with the takedowns, with the top control, like, he is relentless when he's going for this stuff. He's one of the bigger guys at 145, which is why I mentioned the weight cut. So eager to see both these guys on the scales on Friday to make an assessment on Saturday, which brings up Fight Night Picks question mark kicks 2 hours before the prelims. Matt, that one's early on Saturday morning again, because it's another early Fight Night card. So look out for the link on that one here on the channel. It should be a big time weekend of fights, headlined by Curtis Razor Blades taking on Tom of No Fixed Nickname Aspinall. Should be a great one. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, as we always say.
Let's get in.
Last time that we previewed a Nathaniel Wood fight here with the Fight Night Picks channel, we threw darts at a dartboard with new nickname possibilities for Nathaniel Wood. I think when you're in your late 20s, the prospect is, it's just overblown. So what we ended up on, Matt, was I hit the London Lighthouse and you actually hit the British Bruiser. So Matt, hey, listen, we did all that. We got all in depth. We talked so much about Nathaniel Wood, and then he didn't hit the scales, and neither did his opponent, Vince Morales, in a fight that was supposed to take place at 135 at the last O2 show. And a few weeks after that, the end of March, Nathaniel Wood posts a picture to Instagram and he says, I can't do it anymore. I'm not doing the cut down to 135. I am a featherweight. So I look at all of this and it's kind of weird, because if you look at it for Nathaniel Wood and you consider the prospect, the last time that he fought was in a fight of the night at a big time UFC 254 card headlined by Khabib versus Justin Gaethje. That was the retirement of a legend. And in that one, that was October of 2020. So it's almost been 2 years since we've seen Nathaniel Wood step into the cage. It was an amazing fight. He's a former Cage Warriors, two-time defending bantamweight champ. We know exactly what we're going to get with a guy like that. And I mean, whatever you thought about the decision between Wood and Kenny, 29-28's a bound. People were somewhat split on MMA decisions.
It was a close fight.
Yeah, they might have an opinion on it down below in the comments section. But what I do have here is the fact that he's got all sorts of finishes on his record. He has a varied offensive in his first three UFC contests. If you go down and watch that, I mean, yes, he did have that loss to John Dodson where he got finished, which was a surprise to a lot of people. But if you consider it, in some of his fights, it's been a little bit of wrestling. It's been a little bit of pitter-patter. It's been some of those power shots. You look at his last two fights, Matt, he almost looks like a man possessed against John Castaneda and Casey Kenney due to the fact that Nathaniel Wood wasn't necessarily always known as this big-time volume guy. But his volume's been on incredible display in his last two fights.
And the thing about Nathaniel Wood is he is a volume striker, but he's not a one-round fighter. He's not a three-round fighter. He's kind of a two-round fighter, if we're being honest. Like, he can throw that crazy amount of volume. He has good pop at the end of his shots. But at a certain point, it does kind of reach a limit to where Nathaniel Wood isn't the same fighter that he is early in the fights. Like, that's how Casey Kenney was able to make that one close. In the first two rounds, they were going back and forth, a lot of one-for-one striking. But by the time the third round came around, Casey Kenney was just a little bit more active with his strikes. He was landing in that kick to the body a little bit more effectively. I gotta be honest, though. I have no idea why Charles Rosa took this fight. Like, for Charles Rosa, he's 35, almost 36 years old. He was someone who was always a little bit more well-known than your average guy who was in his position in the UFC. I'm not saying Charles Rosa was main event in any fight nights, but you get the idea. Like, John Anik really liked him because of the Boston connection. So, like, it felt like he was always getting hyped up. But, like, is that what Charles Rosa is now? Is he just a guy who fights guys who are going to become ranked fighters at a certain point? And maybe that's putting Nathaniel Wood ahead. That's putting the cart before the horse. But we know how talented Nathaniel Wood is on his best day. He can defend takedowns. He has good power. He has great submissions. Like, he is an extremely well-rounded fighter. Charles Rosa has...
Continue.
Charles Rosa has good jiu-jitsu, but poor wrestling, if we're being honest. He has a weird kind of striking to where it's that karate stance, but he likes to box a lot. I don't think he can get Nathaniel Wood's respect on the feet whatsoever. I really do think if Rosa tries to strike, he lunges forward way too much. And with Nathaniel Wood's accuracy, especially in those first two rounds, I think Wood's going to damage him a lot on the feet.
Yeah, that's the big thing with Nathaniel Wood. A lot of accuracy on the end of his strikes. And when I look at Charles Rosa, a guy who's 5-7 in the UFC, he's taken on some really good names. Don't get me wrong. What was it? Yair Rodriguez was a fight of the night. It was a split decision win for Rodriguez. But I look at the losses. He got dominated in the grappling by Bryce Mitchell. Okay. He got dominated in the grappling by Damon Jackson. Okay. He got dominated in the grappling by Derek Minner. Okay. You get dominated in the grappling
like
by
Lil Jon.
TJ Brown.
Okay.
He had really good output in two of his UFC fights, like really good output against Kyle Bochniak. Like it dropped in that fight. And he had really good output against Shane Burgos. Like it knocked out in that fight. So I have a hard time when I match him up against Nathaniel Wood. Now, listen, let's talk about bigger story arcs here. I mean, you've got Nathaniel Wood representing Great Britain top team, a gym that's coached by Matt's favorite fighter from Britain, a guy with a hat. Now, he's not wearing an angling hat with a Canadian flag in fishing lures, but yeah, Brad Pickett, the man in the hat. But I guess he's not really the man in the hat. Chuck Mendenhall's the man in the hat. We can't take that from him. But when we do look at it overall for Wood, it feels like this is an opportunity to get back in the winner's circle after being away for almost 2 years. And you look at the odds, they respect him. He opened minus 350, minus 506 on best fight odds right now. Rosa opened plus 285, plus 372. We have a look at the Tapology votes. Surprised us there to you. I'm going to say over under 92% Nathaniel Wood, making it hard on you.
I'll say under.
That's what she said. 93%. 1,076 votes. 93% Wood, 80% by decision for the 7% that have Rosa, 59% by decision. So the fans don't have Rosa. The odds don't really respect Rosa. He owns his own gym, American Combat Gym. Yep, he's from Boston.
Unfortunately, his business portfolio is not something that can help him in the cage.
No, I mean, good for him. But yeah, he can't match the output. If he can take Nathaniel Wood down, I guess maybe it could be a size thing. Obviously, we've seen Charles Rosa competing at lightweight and featherweight in his UFC tenure. Nathaniel
Wood's going to look good at featherweight, though, honestly.
His last fight was at a catchweight of 140. But again, that fight was 2 years ago. The only thing that I really have on this one, Matt, I'm going to make sure that I get this one right because we're doing a different setup this week. He's at a 3-inch disadvantage in height. He has the same reach as Charles Rosa. So in those boxing exchanges, I don't see that having this big overarching angle to it.
I think Nathaniel Wood's taller than 5'6". That's all I'm going to say.
I don't know. I'd have to stand next to him. So would you. But when I focus in on this one, yeah, I do have Nathaniel Wood here. Minus 500 is too rich for me. But yeah, I'm looking forward to it. The return.
It should be. It's an interesting fight to see how good Wood does look at 145 pounds. Because let's say his cardio was really affected by the weight cut. Maybe we could even see a better version of him at this weight class because he does have good power. He does have good volume. So if we do get a slightly better version of Nathaniel Wood at 145 pounds, he should fit right into this division, which is already one of the best in the sport. But good on Charles Rosa for taking this fight because it is a very difficult one.
Making an all-British fight. I want to see Nathaniel Wood fight Arnold Allen at some point in the future. Matt, when we do look at this fight, both of us going with good Wood, Nathaniel Wood out of Great Britain top team to get the win. Matt, it'll be an interesting fight. We have plenty of interesting fights left on this card, including Scotland's Paul Craig taking on Switzerland's own Volkan Oezdemir. Listen, you're going to want to keep locked in with Fight Name Picks, as we always say.
Let's get into it.
Coming up this weekend, two big-time prospects that I got super excited about when I got back into MMA, and it's panned out to UFC records of 4-4 for the nearly 36-year-old Demir Hadzevich and 6-5 for Mark Chakassian. Matt, to give a little bit of a backstory, we were MMA fans 2008, 2009, Shogun Hua, Lyoto Machida, George St. Pierre, childhood idols. Then I dropped out of it near the end of high school, and then as I got back into it, 2016-17, that's when Demir Hadzevich and Mark Chakassian became known to the UFC fans. And listen, I got excited about the Teemu Pakkalan knockout. I got excited about a fight with Dan, against Dan Hooker. But when it really does come down to it, it feels nice to me to be able to pat myself on the back and do a damn victory lap with all you Fight Night Picks fans who thought I was some turkey for taking Mark Chakassian back earlier on this year when he was taking on Vyacheslav Borshev. I had Chakassian and I felt great. But I will say this, Matt. Mark Chakassian tried to take a victory lap after that fight, and they gave him Demir Hadzevich. He was so high and mighty after beating Vyacheslav Borshev by taking him down. And granted, all three judges scored at 30-27. He landed 11 of 18 takedowns and had 12 minutes and 24 seconds of control time. But the trouble is, like, A, what do you get out of that? You beat a hot prospect in a non-appealing way. And B, Matt, did it surprise you that Mark Chakassian was able to be that dominant with his wrestling?
It was always a wrinkle of his game that you kind of knew was there, but it was never something he was able to convincingly win a fight with throughout 15 minutes, but that's been the good thing about Mark Chiesa. I do feel like he has grown as a mixed martial artist from when we did see him and kind of remember him for that Timu Paklin knockout, because that was an incredible one-shot KO. If people forget that, I highly recommend going back and watching. We also have to remember the really tough three-fight losing streak he immediately went on after that. He broke his foot against Dracar Close. I'll always remember that. That was just a weird fight because...
And that was just a split decision loss too, right?
It was, but I still feel like Close is able to win that one. Dan Hooker and him had a fun fight until he did get caught in that submission, but Nasrat Haqparast beat the shit out of him. And that's a like nice way of saying it, if we're being completely honest. And I'd kind of written him off going into that Joe Duffy fight, but Chiesa, he showed a new wrinkle of his game. He was a kickboxer. Then he had elbows all of a sudden. He was able to drop Joe Duffy with a really nice elbow. He started using his wrestling a little bit more in that fight. And then against Lando Venata, we saw a lot more of that wrestling game.
Who would have thought that? He completely out-wrestled Lando Venata.
And Venata was another one of these guys who started out very much known as being a striker, who then added the wrestling more to his game as he progressed further. I know he had wrestling earlier on in his career, but he had gone away from it for a little while. So it was really nice to see Chiesa go out there and beat another guy who can get the takedown himself. And then he fought Fazeev, and that's tough. Let's just be honest. Fazeev was able to outclass
him. But that was a fight of the night.
It was a fight of the night, but still, Fazeev was... able to outclass him on the feet. And the Alvesh loss was a really bad one. So that's the thing for Chiesa. More than anybody on this card, it's what version of him do you get? Because when he is the mixed martial artist who can threaten with his strikes, even though that's the thing, I'm starting to think that Mark Chiesa's strikes are more... You're worried about the potential of them more than you should actually be the strikes themselves. Because at this point, Chiesa hasn't hurt anyone on the feet in a meaningful period of time. And that is a little bit concerning because we knew him for the speed and the power so early on in his career that I'm really surprised that he hasn't been able to have that same level of success on the feet. Now, it's great that he's been able to expand his game, but I wonder if him focusing on the grappling has taken away from his striking somewhat.
Yeah, and that's one of those ones, like, you look at Mark Chiesa, and I said, like, this is a guy that I followed very closely since he came into the UFC. He was one of those prospects that 2016-17, you're watching him, you're watching Sage Northcutt, you're watching Paige VanZant, you're getting excited for all these fighters that didn't necessarily pan out for what you expected. But when I look at Chiesa, used to train at American Top Team, made the move over. He's since training at home or closer to home over in the UK. But when I do look at this, Matt, for Demir Hadzevich, we haven't really talked about him, but he has really good striking defense, and it's backed up by the numbers, 62% striking defense. But when you watch Demir Hadzevich, really, really high guard, and he does block a lot of shots with his arms. He does move quite well with the shots, and he can roll with some of those body shots, and he brings his guard right back up. But when I look at it, out of having your hands so damn high and being known as a little bit of a brawler, like pretty much a brawler, 37% takedown defense in the UFC, and that's accentuated by Christos Yagos taking him down on 6 of 13 attempts, Alain Patrick getting him down on 9 of 15 back when Alain was the hotness, and Marcin Held went 4-4 before Demir Hadzevich knocked him out. So I do look at it as, when you watch Demir Hadzevich fight, he's heavy on his boxing. When he gets you backed up against the cage, he unloads. He'll go to the head, he'll go to the body. He throws a ton of power. He throws with speed. He throws with aggression. He's light on kicks. But if you go back and watch his last fight against Yancy Medeiros, he starts that fight off by throwing a good 10 leg kicks hard. And then he kind of turns it down a little bit. But career-wise, he's not this big, big kicker. But again, I do look at this as, Matt, like Demir Hadzevich, he's all over the damn place in terms of his consistency with his performances. He's got a welterweight loss to Christoph Jacko in 2012 that I find interesting. He does, again, very well with his body to head combos. But when it comes to grappling, like, it makes sense that Demir Hadzevich was a bodybuilder before he became a mixed martial artist. Because when he took on Hanato Moicano and he got taken down, and then he got mad that Hanato took him down and wanted to grapple. Like, what? I didn't expect this. We were supposed to strike. I didn't sign up for this.
You wouldn't want to call like a pickup foul on Demir Hadzevich. You know,
no,
like,
he probably plays basketball like Khabib. He just runs around.
Like, he'd just do like a flagrant two, pull you down to the ground and be like, what? And you're not going to say anything. That's Demir Hadzevich. So yeah, probably not the coolest dude to play pickup hoops with. But here's the thing. He's so one note in MMA, and there is a stiffness to his game. He is a brawler, but he doesn't have this flexibility that a lot of other natural strikers are known for. And that does get him caught because he is sort of lungy with some of his strikes. And against a guy like Chiesa, I do think Chiesa is the faster guy on the feet, even though I do worry about where his power is at this stage of his career. Because like I said, it's been a while since he's been able to hurt anyone on the feet. I think Joe Duffy was the last guy we hurt standing at least. So for Chiesa, I just think he's the more well-rounded guy. And for Hadzovic, we've never seen him make the evolution. Like, you can go through losses and come back and have wins, but if you're just getting wins the same way that you were before you suffered those losses, did you really learn anything from those losses in the first place? I don't think Hadzovic is some different fighter than he was before he suffered his losses to Yagos and Moicano, whereas Gekasey, even though he suffered more losses against the upper echelon of the division, I do think he normally comes back learning a new thing about his own game because of those losses, and I think that's really going to be the key to this matchup.
It's another rich pairing. I mean, Matt, Gekasey opened minus 300, minus 327 right now. Hadzovic opened plus 250, plus 259. I don't like Mark Gekasey as a 3-1 favorite in any fight. So if we have a look at the Tapology vote, surprise us there to you. I'm going to say over under. Again, another big favorite. I'm going to say 75% Gekasey.
I got to be honest. I saw so much support for Mark Gekasey on the internet this week and over the weekend that I'm going to say over just because it was insane the amount of other people who make predictions and picks who have picked Mark Gekasey.
91% of 1,178 have Gekasey to win, 78% by decision for the 9% that have Hadzovic, 63% by decision, 22% by knockout. Guys, if Demir Hadzovic beats Mark Gekasey, knocks him out in the first round. Like, we've seen Mark Gekasey knock him out, drag him out type of fight, Rafael Alves, and he gets finished. Like, he will wrestle himself into bad positions, and you could submit him. He will try and lunge in to do different things, and he can get hit. And if you look at it for Demir Hadzovic, he loves that step-in knee, and he likes step-in elbows as well. So if you like Hadzovic, this is a perfect opportunity for him to go in and finish Mark Gekasey. Now, back to my point from last week, I like to take the more well-rounded guy. I say this before the Chanel fight, and then I take Sumit Erji. In this matchup, I like the more well-rounded guy, Mark Gekasey. I like his wrestling. I like the fact that he can wear down a guy like Demir Hadzovic, just like he was able to do against Slava Borshov his last time out. So for that reason, I had Gekasey. But, like, I mean, Demir Hadzovic by finish, maybe it's on the table.
I don't see there being a big avenue for Hadzovic getting the win here. And this is the only reason. He has good striking, but again, his last knockout win was over Polo Reyes, a guy who's known for being on the receiving end of posters. He's like Anderson Varejao at this point of his career. Like, people only remember the curly hair and Dwayne Wade dunking on him. So I just don't think Hadzovic is at that level. I know he had the win over Yancey. Yancey looked good against Emmanuel Sanchez, who's basically a featherweight who is moving up to lightweight, fighting a welterweight who was fighting at lightweight. So I'm not that impressed by a win over Yancey Medeiros, if I'm being completely honest. And I do think Gekasey, if things aren't going well for him on the feet, he will be able to get that takedown. And I do think it'll be as simple as that, because Hadzovic has not shown any ability to improve his own takedown defense throughout the UFC up until this point.
You've got Hadzovic out of Arte Suave training with another guy who's on this card, in a guy who I like but most don't. It's Nicholas Dalby, Matt. In this fight, both of us going with Mark Gekasey to get the win. I'm excited about it. The next fight that's on this card, Mason Jones taking on Ludwig Klein. I know a lot of people are very excited about that one. So keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. And as we always say, let's get into it. Coming up this weekend, a very interesting fight on short notice at lightweight. We have, you have to call me Dragon, Mason Jones out of Wales, the former double champ over with Cage Warriors lightweight and at welterweight, taking on Ludwig Klein, Mr. Highlight, first Slovakian fighter in the UFC. And Matt, Ludwig Klein, pre-UFC, I was so excited. I thought this guy's going to ball out in the UFC. He knocks out Shane Young in his debut, and it's like, wow. We are going off to the races. And then if you look at it for Ludwig Klein, he ends up losing to Mike Trezano by decision. He gets completely outclassed for the majority of the fight. And it was just an odd one. Ludwig tried to go for his wrestling. Mike Trezano was able to pressure him, utilizes good boxing. Then Klein goes out there and fights Nate Landwehr and gets submitted. And then you're like, what? But I thought I knew what I was getting. Like, I thought this guy was the guy that we're on the right track at featherweight. And for Klein, his last time out, he takes on Devontae Smith, and he looked pretty damn good. And I know it's a split decision win and what have you. I thought Klein won two of the rounds. But when I do look at it, Matt, I mean, Ludwig Klein is an odd cat, because we talk about this. I mean, for Rafael Fiziev, he was able to get that win over Dos Anjos. The story, you know, in the early spring when the fight was originally booked, it was like, hey, Fiziev at a big team in Killcliff FC he's been all right, but Tiger Muay Thai physique, that's the guy that we want. And that's what we were supposed to get in that fight. Then ultimately, with everything that happened, he had to reschedule. They pushed the fight later on in the year. Fazeev goes back to train at Killcliff FC, so he's in the States. And I think he looked pretty darn good his last time out. But for Ludwig Klein, I threw this tweet out here not that long ago. Klein is 0-2 in his own weight class in the UFC of 145 pounds, those two losses, Trezano and Landwehr. But he's 2-0 outside of it. One fight at 150 pounds, one fight at 155. He's also 2-0 on short notice fights and 0-2 in full camps. And he's 2-0 fighting out of his own gym of Spartacus and 0-2 fighting out of Killcliff FC. So Matt, perfect storm. That means that this fight's on short notice because originally next weekend, UFC 277, Ludwig Klein was supposed to take on Ignacio Bahamondes. Bahamondes out of the fight. Mason Jones, who trains at Team Alpha Male, now has to go from Team Alpha Male all the way across the world, close to home in London. So it's a hometown game for Jones, but he takes it on short notice. Didn't really have an opponent out there in the air for him. And for Klein, hometown gym, Spartacus, up a weight class. He's 2-0 in these situations in the UFC, and he's already 2-0 on short notice. By the power of MMA, Ludwig Klein wins his fight.
And by my eyes and everything I know about MMA, Mason Jones should not lose this fight. Like, this fight comes down to how much does jet lag affect a person at the end of the day? Because Mason Jones had one of the best fights no one ever remembers against Mike Davis. Just, it was really good. I highly recommend going back and watching it.
I threw this out there on Reddit here last week. I said, somebody said, what's a fight that didn't win fight of the night that people forget about? And I said, and I will take this to my friggin' grave. David Onama, Mason Jones, and Junyoung Park Gregory Rodriguez won it because of a crazy minute of action. I thought that fight was great too.
They were both great. And that's the thing with Mason Jones. He's willing to eat a shot to just move forward with his pressure, be it his boxing or his wrestling, because we know how good both aspects of his game are. If he can eat shots from Mike Davis, one of the most heavy-handed guys in the lightweight division, I know he's not that active, so maybe people who haven't watched Mike Davis enough would really be against that statement. But again, watch him fight. He's got very, very heavy hands and very crisp boxing. If you're willing to eat bombs from him, clean shots from David Onama as well, I don't think Ludwig Klein's going to be able to knock out Mason Jones. Jones is the much bigger man, which does matter in this fight because he's basically a welterweight who fights at lightweight. Like, he's going to be as big of a lightweight as you can possibly find in the majority of his fights. And the fact that Ludwig Klein doesn't really belong in this weight division to begin with, it is a little bit concerning. And I do agree with you. I think that there's a point of diminishing returns with Ludwig Klein's weight cut because at 145 pounds, let's be honest, he just doesn't look as good. I still don't think the added 10 pounds is going to be enough for him to really have enough power on his strikes to get rid of that forward pressure from Mason Jones, because if Jones gets Klein up against the cage, it's going to look terrible. Like, he's going to box him up, go to the body, go to the head. He's really going to be able to inflict a lot of damage in that scenario. Whereas Ludwig Klein's going to have to set up a lot of traps on the feet in this fight for him to be able to have success with the striking. And Klein might be able to do that in the second, third round if he was fighting a guy who didn't have constant pressure from the second the fight starts. Because that's the thing about Mason Jones. He fights at a very high pace, and he can keep that very high pace, especially for a 15-minute fight. I just think this is an extremely tough matchup for Ludwig Klein. I know he's going to have the benefit of Jones basically flying to the other side of the world, switching who knows however many time zones, but Jones, at the end of the day, is the much more, and I mean much more, skilled mixed martial artist in this matchup.
Yeah, like, folks that are out there listening to this, you might find it really silly, but Ludwig Klein, again, pre-UFC, the tape study on him, this guy is a wild striker. His head kicks are great. His boxing combinations are great. His kicks to the body are great. At 145, he's his force, and now in the UFC at 150 and 155, he's still that very good fighter, and I agree, like, my point is, when I look at Ludwig Klein at 155, the guy's full of size and muscle, and he looks like he belongs at 155. At 145, it's like, yeah, you know, you drained yourself. Can you still defend the takedowns? Can you still match the output of a speedier, you know, thinner fighter? Like, it is a really weird one. So I think Klein, I'd love to see him stick around at lightweight. I think he could have a lot of fun fights. For Mason Jones, I love the wrestling chops. His boxing combinations are great. Like, I've touched on it. Like, you know, every time that you see somebody throw a jab to the body, you think, geez, that's smart. Why don't more guys do that?
And then my boy Lee Ching Liang was like, what if I only did that?
Yeah, but if you do watch a guy like Mason Jones, he will do that, rip back up to the head, so on and so forth. Tucker a poor fella out. And you saw him against David Onama, a much smaller fighter coming in on short notice at 155. And by smaller, like, you look at him at 145, and he, to me, David Onama looks like he belongs at 145. But with Mason Jones, it's, I know he can keep out the keep the output going throughout a, you know, three round fight or a five round fight. And I look at him as, yeah, he is the much better wrestler. Ludwig Klein, I don't necessarily doubt his takedown defense, but I look at the matchup, Matt. Jones open minus 325, minus 336. This fight was just announced. Again, Klein was supposed to take on the kickboxer, Ignacio Bahamondes out of Chile. You look at Klein, open plus 275, plus 261. We have a look at the Tapology votes, Matt. Surprise us there to you. I'm going to say 80% Jones over under.
I'll say over.
89% Jones out of 946 total votes. 65% have Jones by decision, 24% by knockout for the 11% that have Klein, 61% by decision, 20% by knockout. Matt, this is one of those cards. There's a lot of big favorites. You hate to be the sap sucker or the energy sucker out of the room and pick another big favorite, but I like Mason Jones in this fight. But again, honest to goodness, I'd stay away just because you got to fly all the way across the world. You're the one that's taking this fight on short notice. Ludwig Klein was already in a fight camp, and he's supposed to fight next week in the States. So he only has to go from Slovakia to England instead of going from California to England. So Klein's got a great opportunity as a big underdog in this fight, no matter what anybody says. If you just focus on A's and B's and 1's and O's and X's and O's in this fight, you might have a very strong case for Mason Jones. But there is a human element to this one, and I think that that has to be at least accentuated here.
I worry about the flight, but I got to be honest. That's the only thing that worries me about Mason Jones in this matchup. He's fought guys who would beat Ludwig Klein, and he's been able to beat guys who would be able to beat Ludwig Klein. I think David Onama is a much better fighter than Ludwig Klein, if I'm being completely honest. Like, if those guys fought, I would probably pick David Onama. And I understand Mason Jones is taking this fight on short notice. I am curious, though, if this kind of being his natural time zone, if you will help him somewhat acclimatize to the quick turnaround. I know that might be a stretch on my part. I'm just saying maybe it will help him a slight bit with this, but again, Jones is the much more talented guy, and he's extremely durable, too. It's not like there's a question mark in the back of my mind of, oh, if Ludwig Klein just catches him with a good shot early. Like, yes, that's a possibility in every fight because this is MMA, but for durability's sake, I would say Mason Jones is as durable as an MMA fighter can get, so I do like Jones in this fight.
Both of us going with Wales Dragon, Mason Jones, and not just the dragon that's in the flag. Matt, I think we have a big-time card, and when we're talking about fighters out of the UK, Scotland's Paul Craig is going to be taking on Switzerland's Volkan Oezdemir. That one is next. It's at light heavyweight. You're not going to want to miss this. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. As we always say,
let's get into it.
Volkan Oezdemir is still removed from consciousness.
Saturday afternoon, I'm going to have a soda pop. I'm going to have a popcorn. I'm going to be sitting there like Shia LaBeouf watching his own movies, laughing and crying. We have ranked light heavyweights in the top 10. Your number 8 ranked Paul Craig. Take on number 9 ranked Volkan Oezdemir. For Paul Craig, like, he's calling a shot. He wants a title shot. So Matt, I'm going to start this video off in a weird way by saying, for Paul Craig, I hate the fact that just a couple of weeks ago, he posted on his Instagram where he's in the gym, he's completely drenched in sweat, his hair is perfect, like his hair is absolutely perfect, but he's grappling and wearing a Cleveland Cavaliers jersey. Matt, the number on the Cleveland Cavaliers jersey, it's not 6, it's not 23, it's the jersey worn by the 2008 number 5 overall pick, your 2016 NBA champ. It's number 0. Matt, do you know the number? Do you know the
Anderson Varejao?
Kevin Love. Don't like that. Yes, it would be. Don't like that. Hate it. Hate it. Absolutely.
I like Kevin Love.
Where did Paul Craig get a Kevin Love jersey? We got to ask him. We got to figure that out.
A guy who changed his body type for the better success of his team, and that's something that's very admirable. So guess what? I'm not here to talk shit about Kevin Love.
Fair enough. But I guess the big question that I have for Saturday is, and this is an overarching thing for Paul Craig's career, can he survive against another striker? Is he going to be able to get it done? I mean, his UFC record, Matt, 8-4-1, and he's on a 4-fight win streak right now. Like, if he gets this win, does he get the title shot? Because 7 of his 8 wins in the UFC are by submission. He has 1 knockout win. Those 7 wins by submission are all performance of the night bonuses. So a giant opportunity for him, a huge amount of experience in the cage. But it's can he survive the big storm? He did it against Nikita Krylov somehow. The referee let him take bops off the head while his eyes were just kind of like open.
You got to stop. He wasn't out that bad. As someone who picked Nikita Krylov, Craig Allen, I feel like that's heavily influencing this.
It was kind of silly. But realistically, though, Matt, like, can he get it done? We're going to have to find that out this weekend.
You say, can he weather the storm? When was the last time Volkan Oezdemir brought a storm in a fight? It was the Aliyev Latifi performance, and that was years ago now. That's really been the problem with Oezdemir. He's got good kickboxing, I would say borderline great kickboxing. He throws a nice inside leg kick. He has really good boxing combinations. But the problem is, he's one of these strikers who can get caught in neutral sometimes, and we've definitely seen that his last two performances.
He gets so hesitant.
He does, and it's one of those things where it reminds me of Jason Tatum. Like, my buddy Colby and I, when we used to live together, we'd watch a lot. Every time the Celtics and Raptors would play, we'd make sure we'd watch it, because he's a big Celtics fan, big Raptors fan. And the thing that would always bother us about Jason Tatum was, he'd be the best player on the court, but this is back when the Raptors had Serge Ibaka. Ibaka would block him one time, and Jason Tatum would never go to the hoop again. And it's very similar to Volkan Oezdemir getting touched up on the feet. Once he feels his opponent's power, he does become a much more hesitant fighter. And you can even look at the Jiří Procházka fight to really help you with that, because he hurts Procházka early. He's having a lot of success in the first round of that fight. But the second Jiří starts to build momentum, you can tell. Volkan starts backing up a little bit more. He becomes a more hesitant fighter, and that's never something you want to see from a guy who's so good when he does move forward.
I completely disagree with that point, only because if you go back and you watch his last fight, at moment 214 of the first round, you've got a big left cross that hits Volkan Oezdemir, drops him, he gets back up, and as it's all happening, Paul Felder, you can hear it, just it's not very loud. He goes, oh boy, like, he knows what's going on. Volkan Oezdemir came back and won the second round of that fight. So it's not like he crumbled under the pressure. He was able to come back, win the second round, and then lose the third round, and he loses 29-28, but I don't
but
think
the thing is, you Volkan Oezdemir, you should probably be able to beat guys like Ankalaev. Like, you're on the level of guys like Ankalaev, I would say.
This is the one thing, Matt. So you look at this division, and there's so many, like, ups and downs and giant swings. Like, I look at guys similar to Volkan Oezdemir right now, like Johnny Walker, highest of highs, lowest of lows, Ryan Spann, Dominic Reyes. Like, these are the guys that are all lumped into the same category for me. But out of Volkan Oezdemir, he wins his first three fights. Obviously, the Ovince St. Preux fight, split decision. He caps it off with the Jimmy Manoa knockout, which is wild. It's no time mania. Craig Allen goes to UFC 220 with his buddies. And then Daniel Cormier gets him into a crucifix and finishes him. And if you look at it, since that fight, he's 2-5 in the UFC. His win over Alexander Rakic is highly contentious. So say what you will. He obviously knocked out Aliyev Latifi. But I look at this one. He's training at All-Stars. He's had prior camps at All-Stars. He's there with a guy in Alexander Gustafsson that looks physically very, very good. Not like a bag of milk, like his picture that you're going to see coming up later is his heavyweight turn at 240. But I look at this one, Matt. Volkan Oezdemir has very good takedown defense. That's been a key. Now, again, I said before we came on, I went back and I watched some of his fights. His fight against Kelly Knudsen with Bellator. Kelly was a former Bellator title challenger. He took on Liam McGarry. He was on The Ultimate Fighter season 19. He was a wrestler, and he used, like, body lock takedowns and some really interesting takedowns to get Volkan to the mat. He was able to really stifle his game and striking, and he ended up submitting him. But realistically, Matt, I mean, this is one of those fights that, like, it's really, really tough to see what we're going to get out of Volkan Oezdemir. It's tough to project the guy that I know could knock out Paul Craig. But at the same time, Paul Craig's there to get hit a lot of the time.
And this is the thing about Volkan Oezdemir. You bring up that loss to Kelly Knudsen. Look at his win against Aliyev Latifi. He did defend the majority of those takedowns. Like, there has been a progression in his takedown defense since that fight that was almost 10 years ago. So I do think for Oezdemir, he has been able to improve that area of his game. But the weird thing about Paul Craig is takedown defense doesn't matter because nothing he does is traditional. I know that's a weird thing to say, but it's the truth. His jiu-jitsu is as deadly as anybody in the UFC's, and that is not a stretch whatsoever. Like, every second you spend with Paul Craig on the mat is a second that you could get your arm broken. You could get choked unconscious. Like, this guy has a squeeze like few other in really the division, if not the organization. Because for Paul Craig, I remember the Jamal Hill fight. Like, Jamal Hill to me is way better than Volkan Oezdemir at this stage of his career. They fight in a very similar manner. It's just Hill's a lot younger. He's a lot more explosive, I'd say, at this stage of his career. But the thing was, Jamal Hill went in very overconfident. Hey, I'm pretty good at jiu-jitsu too. He doesn't want to see me grapple. Fighting Paul Craig really does come down to how good is your fight IQ. And for Volkan Oezdemir, we've seen him struggle with his fight IQ against some natural strikers to where, like we've said, he does become hesitant if he does get touched up on the feet. Paul Craig's a different kind of fighter, though. He's going to make you hesitant, but it's going to come with his grappling. And I know Paul Craig likes to say in every interview, like, hey, in the gym, my striking's really good. It's just one of those things that I got to translate into the cage and do it when the lights are shining the brightest. I just don't know if Paul Craig can strike with Volkan Oezdemir in this matchup. The problem is, though, is this version of Volkan Oezdemir that dangerous? Like, kind of, it's like what I said about Mark Giacchese there a couple videos ago. Like, Giacchese's a good striker, but if you're being honest with yourself, when was the last time he really hurt somebody on the feet? It's been a little while. For Volkan Oezdemir, he hasn't looked as dangerous in recent memory. Like, no time is starting to fade. Damian Lillard can still touch his wrist because he gets crazy shot after crazy shot. You can't go by no time if you no longer knock people out the first round. And we haven't seen Oezdemir do that in a convincing amount of time.
The odds surprised me in this one, Matt, because Paul Craig opened a plus 170. He's plus 140 right now. As we were doing this video, I went back to double check that that wasn't Volkan Oezdemir. Oezdemir open minus 200, minus 170. If we have a look at the Tapology votes, Matt, it is a surprise to me, as it is to you, as it is to all of us. Paul Craig, your number 8 ranked light heavyweight. Oezdemir at number 9. I'm going to say over under 65% Paul Craig, even though he's the underdog. I think he's got the fan support over there.
I'll say under.
I'm going to say under. Oh my, 1,223 total votes, 76% Paul Craig, 82% by submission for the 24% that of Volkan Oezdemir, 78% by knockout. I'm going to say this for the fans out there. Fight Night Picks was there for the fight, but go back and watch UFC Moncton. Go back and watch Anthony Smith when he's taking on Volkan Oezdemir. Anthony Smith submits Volkan Oezdemir. Was it because his takedown and his jiu-jitsu were lights out as I struggled to get that out of there? No, he peppered him up against the cage with a ton of strikes. He really poured the pressure on, hurt Volkan Oezdemir, gets him down to the mat, and then he's able to use his Brazilian jiu-jitsu black belt. Anthony Smith is a very, very special fighter because does he have the best chin? Does he accept pressure all that well? Maybe not necessarily, but complete package? Anthony Smith's a complete package. He could have been your light heavyweight champ if he accepted an illegal knee disqualification. So be that as it may, Anthony Smith poured the pressure on a lot of different ways. Paul Craig doesn't strike like Anthony Smith. Paul Craig is not that guy. But is Volkan Oezdemir that guy? That's why I do struggle with this one. It is a tough one to call. It really is.
I understand Volkan Oezdemir is the favorite, but I got to be honest. I think he gets mopped in this fight. I don't often speak in those terms, but when are we going to stop doubting Paul Craig? Because here's the thing, I picked Nikita Krylov in our prediction video for his fight. And then on question mark kicks, I know what I said. I said, hey, this guy's on a 3-fight win streak. He's looked great in all these fights. Like, at a certain point, you have to take this stuff seriously. Like, he doesn't get all these submission wins because he's bad at the sport of MMA. It's the complete opposite. Like, Paul Craig is one of the best grapplers in this sport. And I do think it's just a matter of if he can take down Volkan Oezdemir one time, if he can pull guard one time, just make Oezdemir feel uncomfortable enough to where Oezdemir's not throwing everything in all of his shots, because Oezdemir is kind of a single strike thrower. He will set up his big power shots. And I do think that if he sets up that big power shot and misses off of it, it's going to leave him off balance and available to get taken down by a guy like Paul Craig. And I do think Craig's jiu-jitsu and his ground and pound is great too. That's the other thing about Craig. You know, he doesn't really get the credit for it because his submissions are so good, but I do feel like that's worth bringing up. It's not just the Shogun Hua fight where he made him quit, but still, Paul Craig gets work done when he's on top, be it either passing your guard, going for a submission, getting good groundwork done. Like, he really is the total package with his grappling, and I do think this is going to be the fight that helps him break through, because beating Jamahal Hill is a good win over a prospect, but Jamahal Hill, especially at that time, was still unproven. Shogun was over the hill. Nikita Krylov, you never know what version of him you're going to get. If you go out there and beat Volkan Oezdemir, I know he doesn't always look great against elite levels of competition, but he rarely just gets destroyed by them either. So I do think this is going to be a fun fight, but I don't know how Paul Craig loses this one.
I see people out there in the comment section for our co-main event, Jack Hermanson, Chris Curtis, and I should say for our main event, Curtis Blaydes and Tom Aspinall. I don't want to pick on anybody, but I did see somebody say out there, well, Tom Aspinall has 100% takedown defense. Tom Aspinall's defended 2 takedowns in the UFC.
Never both against a guy like Curtis Blaydes.
They were both against Sergey Spivak, and who's a good grappler, but still. Volkan Oezdemir has 80% takedown defense against good grapplers, and that's he's against them. Like, that's 6 of 30 that have landed against Volkan Oezdemir. And Dominic, gee whiz, There's Dominic Cruz DC and there's Daniel Cormier DC. Daniel Cormier was able to get two of those. If Dominic Cruz was getting takedowns on Volkan Oezdemir, like, we're on Mars. That's how that one works. But when I do look at it, good enough takedown defense. Can he keep the fight standing? Can he implement his leg kick? Can he get his boxing going? I think this fight's going to go longer than people anticipate. And for that reason, I think Volkan Oezdemir is going to be able to get the win. And I hate to say it, and I hate to go against Paul Craig. It seems like that's
what I do on this channel. Have you ever picked Paul Craig? Yeah.
I don't think I have. But when I do look at this one, I do like the fact that Oezdemir is continually training at All-Stars. And I know a lot was made out of the fact that he was at the old Sanford MMA. Things for him in the States kind of fizzled out. So he's been at All-Stars with Chimaev, with
Gustafsson. Better not look at his girl.
But I think those are two really good guys to train with for a fight like this. Reza Madadi.
Come on now.
Reza Madadi. Me switching letters. I'm having a hard time with this one. But I think that's a good coach to have, especially as well, in your corner for this one. So we're split on the pick. I think this is going to be an amazing fight. Let us know down below in the comment section who you have. Is it going to be Paul Craig out of Scotland wearing his Kevin Love basketball jersey? Will it be No Time? Monsieur Volkan Oezdemir out of the French part, Freiburg, out of Switzerland. I think it's going to be an amazing fight, Matt. I think we're going to learn a lot, especially we're going to gain some parity in this division that is light heavyweight, always in flux. It's a big-time fights coming up on this card, Matt. The next one as we turn and burn, Molly McCann taking on Hannah Goldschmidt. So, Matt, you're going to want to keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, as we always say.
Let's get into it.
Big time fight coming up this weekend between Barstool Sports' own and Liverpool's own Molly McCann. The nickname is Meatball. She's going to be taking on 24K Hannah Goldie Goldschmidt. And Matt, when I do look at this fight for Hannah Goldie, she came in on Dana White's Contender Series 2019, week number one, which is a week that low-key was like the best. I mean, Jorgen De Castro gets a big win. You had Bill Algeo taking on Brendan Lochnane, and Dana White said, no, we're not signing Brendan Lochnane. And Puna Soriano took on Jamie Pickett in the main event of that card. But in Hannah Goldie's fight, these were the quotes that Dana White had about her after the fight. He said, looks promising, looks tough. She needs more experience. So what happens, Matt? She sits on the shelf for a month and a half, and the UFC signs her to fight Miranda Granger because she didn't get any more experience, and she didn't get anything that Dana White said that he wanted out of her. So she takes on Miranda Granger. And that fight was what that fight was. And I mean, if you look at it for a fighter like Hannah Goldie, it's a lot of volume, a little bit of pop at the end of her shots, but she loses to Granger. She fights Dana Belbizia and really didn't do all that well in that fight. She gets dropped. And then her last time out, she took on 4-4 Spitfire Emily Whitmire, yep, and submitted her in the first round. And I kind of have this, you know, bad taste in my mouth when we have these fighters and we make these graphics up and then you have to just kind of scrap it and move on. But she's supposed to take on Jinyu Fry, did up the graphics for that one. She wasn't able to make the walk in that fight. And ultimately, she gets booked in this one at 125 against Molly McCann. And it's kind of the interesting thing about Hannah Goldie, because just to, you know, use the benefit of my mind's eye, if it's even a benefit at some points in time, and I look at her and I think, geez, Hannah Goldie's a strawweight. But then I look at it, she's had two fights at flyweight in the UFC and one fight at strawweight. And if you look at it in her career, she's had three fights at 115 and five of them have been at 125. So majority of her career is actually at flyweight. She's a fighter who's going to have a height and reach disadvantage in a lot of her fights, but this actually isn't one of them. They're going to square up. So the stats say, well, I'm eager to see both of them. But if you do look at it for Goldie, four UFC fight bookings have fallen through, two against Jessica Penne, one against Jinyu Fry and one against Loma Lookbunmi early on in that UFC career. So this is an interesting one because I know a lot of people want to hear us talk about Molly McCann, but Hannah Goldie in the grand scheme of things, I don't know what kind of box you can put her in the scheme of the strawweight division, the flyweight division. I just don't really know where she fits in.
This is a, oh, Molly McCann, you're a big star over here. We should probably get you a fight, kind of a fight. What is Hannah Goldie going to do to counter the inside boxing of Molly McCann? I have no idea, because the thing about McCann is everyone's going to talk about how good her boxing is, and it is good. She has good power. Everyone knows that crazy spinning elbow she was able to land in her last fight. But McCann is a decent offensive wrestler, too, and she does add that to her game. because of her intense forward pressure, because she moves forward so much with her own boxing that, hey, if I crash distance, well, the next best option is I should just go for a takedown. And it has worked out throughout some of her fights, but you can tell that when she fights anybody with sort of a jiu-jitsu background, they can take advantage of her over-aggression in her fighting style. I just don't know what Hannah Goldie's going to do to counter the strengths of Molly McCann, because Goldie's someone who will play that striking game a little bit with Molly McCann, but I don't think she has the power that can hurt McCann, whereas McCann definitely has enough power to hurt Hannah Goldie on the outside. And this is the other thing, too, that's really key in this matchup. Goldie's someone who's happy moving backwards. She's not going to stand and firmly plant her feet down and be like, hey, I'm not moving back. If she gets backed up against the cage against Molly McCann, she's going to be at the mercy of McCann, because McCann can then decide, hey, I'm going to strike or I'm going to wrestle. And really, the fighter who's going to be able to switch it up, be it on the feet or on the mat, is probably going to be the fighter who wins this one.
If you want to play MMA math, like, this is the midpoint of this prediction video preview, so you can take a little time out and think of it this way. MMA math says that Hannah Goldie beat Jillian Robertson, and Jillian Robertson beat Molly McCann, so Hannah Goldie beats Molly McCann, but it's not really that way. And if you do look at it again, yeah, like you said, better wrestlers beat Molly McCann. Lara Procopio was able to take her down 7 times. Tyler Santos absolutely dominated that fight, took her down 5 times. And if you watch Molly McCann's last fight, I get it. She's former Cage Warriors flyweight champ. She was able to get that done. Third round spinning back fist. Carolina's eyes were in the back of her head. And I got to say, weirdest flex ever. Molly McCann runs outside of the cage, hugs Dana White, grabs a replica belt, and then brings it into the cage.
Here's the one thing that I like about boxing quite a bit more than MMA. In boxing, when you knock somebody unconscious and you're a little concerned about their health, do you know what they do? They don't celebrate. They walk back to their corner. They'll high five people, but they normally wait for their opponent to get up and be breathing before they start doing backflips off the cage. Whereas Molly McCann was like, ooh, I could fight Valentina. And I have bad news for Molly McCann. That wouldn't be a great fight for her, even though I do feel like Valentina's starting to fade a little bit.
Matt, when you watched that last fight, she had that huge moment 30 seconds into the fight against Carolina where she emptied the tank. And, I mean, some referees would have ended that fight. Maybe it could have been a standing TKO. So she wins the first round, and she has good cage control. She had a couple takedown attempts. Round two was close. Luana Carolina rallied right back. And in the third round, Luana Carolina was winning it until Molly McCann closed the distance and threw the spinning back fist. So if McCann didn't land that knockout, she probably would have lost that fight. Again, maybe something else crazy would have happened, but she probably would have lost that fight 2-1.
And that's kind of the surprising thing about McCann. Has she gotten better since she's been in the UFC, or is she just pretty much the exact same fighter? Because I do feel her wrestling has been more refined, but let's be honest, her strengths are still her strengths, and her weaknesses are still her weaknesses. If you are a good volume striker who can move well on the feet, you can probably tag and move away from Molly McCann. If you are a good grappler, maybe not just a wrestler, but a good grappler, you can have success against someone like Molly McCann. So I am kind of curious as to why she is the name that she is for how talented of a fighter she is, because I get her personality. She's someone who is very loud. She gets in front of a lot of cameras. That's always a positive when you're in a sport like this, but it does feel like Molly McCann's always set up for, hey, she's two fights away for a title shot, where if you watch her fights, you really hope that's not the case whatsoever, because McCann is still basically fighting entry-level UFC levels of competition, to where it's been years now. That Jillian Robertson fight was a long time ago, and it really doesn't feel like Molly McCann's fighting the upper echelon fighters like she should be at this stage of her career.
It really is a hard one, and I know, a lot of people aren't going to want to hear that, but that's just where we're at. So I look at McCann, open minus 200. One of the bigger stars on this card is Molly McCann. She's a minus 400 favorite right now. And for Hannah Goldie, open plus 170, plus 300. We have a look at the Tapology votes, Matt. I'm gonna say again, surprise us there to you. I'm going to say over under 93% Molly McCann.
I'll say over just because she's so much more famous.
1,204 total votes, 92% Molly McCann. 79% by decision, 13% by knockout. For the 8% that have Goldie, 73% by decision. Just enjoy the fight for what it's worth, because minus 400 Molly McCann is weird.
Yeah, I'm not a huge Molly McCann fan, just based on her ceiling. She's 32 years old. At a certain point, you have to start fighting ranked fighters. It's, That's kind of my thing. Like, if you've been around for this long and you're pushed this heavily by the promotion, you should be fighting better fighters. I know Patty Pimblett has the same knock, but the difference is Patty Pimblett's only fought 3 times in the UFC. Like, there's still more time for him to marinate and get better, whereas McKay's been around for almost 5 years now, which is a very long time for someone to just be an unranked fighter in a division like flyweight, which isn't a deep division whatsoever.
To give the folks a bit of a background, too, for Molly McCann, she's been an underdog 1 time in her UFC career, minus 155 Robertson, 205 Cachoeira, plus 215 Lipsky, that was the only time, minus 650 against Belbizia, minus 205 favorite against Tyler Santos, a famous use of the L word that I had, Molly McCann versus Tyler Santos, minus 120 against Lara. Now it's Fritzen, formerly Procopio, Ji-Hyun Kim, minus 120 and minus 140 against Luana Carolina. And that Ji-Hyun Kim fight wasn't a cakewalk either. So I have Molly McCann in this fight. I like the forward pressure. I like the aggression. I like the takedowns, so on and so forth. The complete package, I do. It's just Hannah Goldie can volume strike out there, and she can throw in combination. Dana White's thing was there wasn't a whole lot of pop at the end of her shots, and she did have that nice submission win against Emily Whitmire last time out. But I'm eager to see how it translates for Goldie as, you know, an underdog against such a big favorite, especially not hometown because she's from Liverpool and she's fighting in London, but as close as a hometown fight as is going to get unless it's in Liverpool. So both of us going with Molly McCann in this one, but just watch the fight, enjoy it for what it's worth, and skip on to the next one, which of course is Nikita Krylov, the minor, against Alexander Gustafsson. Matt, I absolutely love these fights. We got a big time fight night card coming up this weekend that you're not going to want to miss. Keep locked in with Fight Night Picks, as we always say. Let's get into it. I'm going to let you in on a little slice of Craig Allen. You know me from Fight Night Picks. You know me as a guy who apparently sports LL Bean shirts on the channel. I like to have fun. I like to talk fights. But when I'm not watching fights, which is legitimately 90% of my life, people are like, Craig, what do you do?
Why'd you say I like to have fun like Kawhi Leonard? Like, at least try to convince people that you do. I like to have fun.
But wow, realistically, Craig. And my wife had this conversation with, I would say my mom, but it's actually our mom. If you didn't know we're brothers, yeah. We are. But we went to a CFL game this weekend and we were driving in the vehicle and Crosby, Stills, Nash came on and I blared it. And they were like, Craig, what the fuck are you doing? And I went, no, I don't really listen to rap that much anymore. Like, I like to keep it mellow. And our mom laughed quite a bit. And Amanda goes, no, Julie, Craig's the most stoner music guy that you had no idea. Doesn't smoke dope, but he is the weirdest. So if you went onto my Apple Music and you just hit play, there would be Chance the Rapper. There would be Crosby, Stills, and Nash. There'd be Billy Strings as well. And if you want to know, like, what are some movies that I like to watch? Well, like, my favorite movie of all time, and this is going to sound weird too, is the movie Goon. I love that movie. I can recite passages. I've seen it 100 times.
Is the moral of the story, Craig, not a stoner, but playlist would suggest he is, Alan?
The part about it is, this fight coming up this weekend between Krylov and Gustafsson, it's weird, but it's right into my wheelhouse and it should be in your wheelhouse too. It is so odd because if you look at it, Matt, Nikita Krylov is ranked in this one. He's a top ranked UFC light heavyweight. Alexander Gustafsson hasn't won a meaningful fight in years and years and years. And it didn't even compute into my brain. The last time Alexander Gustafsson won a fight, he absolutely dusted Glover Teixeira during the daytime. Back in 2017, he fought at UFC 232 for the title. And I thought, geez, that was like what? Like last year? Craig, that was in 2018. Like, I have to remind myself of these things. So it really is weird. I don't know what Alexander Gustafsson is anymore. I don't know who he is. He loses to Jones. He fights Anthony Smith. He looks like a wet paper bag. And then he goes out there and he fights Fabricio Werdum, who apparently is like Muay Thai ready. Again, Fabricio's back. Let's get the bag over with PFL Werdum. And Gustafsson looked completely lost at heavyweight. Like, he looked like he didn't even belong in the cage that night. And I know that's harsh and it's kind of rude. And I mean it with, you can't say mean it with respect because it wasn't a nice thing for me to say. But Alexander Gustafsson didn't look like the guy that he used to look like. And we have to realize he's 10-7 in the UFC. He's in the Hall of Fame for goodness sake, but it's just really hard to get a read on Gustafsson, especially now having not won a fight since 2017.
He's left so much of himself in the cage, it's ridiculous. Like, you cannot go through fights like Alexander Gustafsson has gone through and still be the same fighter at 35 years of age. It's just the truth. And I do worry about him moving back down to 205 pounds. It did feel like he kind of left the division behind when he did move up to heavyweight, because that was the thing is, hey, Gustafsson, a huge light heavyweight, could fight Stipe, like, if he is able to get the win over Verdum. That was something that was paraded around quite a bit. They're both boxers. They could make this happen. But he looked terrible against Fabricio Verdum, who himself didn't look very good leading up to that performance.
He had just lost to Alexio Linick at Fabricio Verdum.
In not a very good fight for either guy. It was kind of a showcase of older talent, and it just showed that, hey, the heavyweight division might not be the healthiest that it's ever been.
And then Verdum looks like a guy from 10 years prior who would finish Fedor Emelianenko's giant win streak.
So that's the thing. For Gustafsson, you can't go into this expecting the guy that he used to be, because it's just impossible. But he is probably going to be the better striker in this matchup. This is my problem with Gustafsson. I don't know how hard of a fight he's willing to go through. Let's just call it what it is. Like, if Gustafsson is getting beat for two rounds, let's say he's underneath Krylov, Krylov's landing good ground and pound, I don't think Gustafsson's going to fight like hell to get back up to his feet and go for a knockout. Like, I could see him just giving up his back and losing via rear naked choke to Nikita Krylov midway through the second round of a tough fight. Because Krylov is one of those guys who, if there is a sign of weakness in you, he can take advantage of that. If you're very skilled and you have really good heart, you can beat what Krylov is. But if there is any quit to you, that's the kind of fighter Krylov can take advantage of, because he's one of these weird guys who has a ton of submission wins, a ton of submission losses, a ton of knockout wins, and a ton of knockout losses. He's an offensive dynamo who risks so much defensively because he is so good offensively.
Nikita Krylov's average fight time in the UFC, a career that spanned a very long time, it's 8-7, so neither guy is a saint. And for Krylov, it's been heavyweight and light heavyweight as well. He debuted at heavyweight as a very young man. Average fight time for Krylov, 7 minutes. For Gustafsson, 10 minutes and 54 seconds. So that is, like, there are finishes there. We do know this. But for Krylov, he left the UFC, loses to, it was Misha Cirkunov, goes to Fight Nights Global, gets some wins, comes back to the UFC, and he's been 2-4 since. You look at the losses. Jan Blachowicz, who became champ, Glover Teixeira, who became champ, Magomed Ankalaev, future champ, Paul Craig, man from Scotland, who's very, very good.
You know, I'm going to zag hard on the Ankalaev future champ, but this is the only thing I want to say. Just his wins in Fight Night Global weren't that great in hindsight. It was an old Emmanuel Newton. Yeah. Exactly. It was an old Emmanuel Newton who was decent in his prime, but at that stage, he was, like, really past it. And Fabio Maldonado, God love him, he was in one of those Bigfoot Silva runs.
A Yuri Prochazka poster.
Yeah, they were like, Bigfoot Silva at this stage is just like, it's sad. They're just like giving him a finder's fee, basically. That's the stage that Fabio Maldonado was at a certain point. It was like, hey, you're a champion, we'll sign him just so you can beat him.
This is my big note on Nikita Krylov. Great first rounds against Ankalaev and against Paul Craig until things don't go well. And I have fight IQ of a wizard sometimes and an acorn some other times. Like, there are two polar opposite versions of Nikita Krylov. Like, when he fought Johnny Walker, hey, I'm going to wrestle him, hold him down the whole time. Hey, works pretty damn good. And then I'm going to go out there and strike against strikers. Not going to work all that great, though he does have very good striking. And he has very good jiu-jitsu, but against Paul Craig, I thought he had him finished. I thought any sane referee is going to jump in when you're hammer-fisting a guy who's not defending and just looking up at the sky. But apparently the magical powers came from the sky for him. But Matt, when you do focus in on it, as your mic is muted, when you do look at it, again, I focus in on Nikita Krylov. Still spry on the feet, still has good takedowns, still has good jiu-jitsu. I haven't seen it from Gustafsson in almost 5 years. I have a hard time picking Alexander Gustafsson in this fight. And old Craig only picks favorites. This is another really tough one, guys.
I like Krylov in this matchup, but I got to be honest. I think he struggles against anybody who has, like, real promise in this division.
Let's Jamal Hill beats Nikita Krylov. Unless Hill goes, I'm a black belt, watch out, guys.
Beats Nikita Krylov. Krylov doesn't make it out of the first round if he fights Jamal Hill. What are we talking about? Like, that's how much better I think a true prospect is in this division than Nikita Krylov. Krylov loves to make mistakes that his opponents are really good at capitalizing on. The thing is, Gustafsson doesn't really have one-punch power at this division. He's more of an accumulation guy. And if you make one mistake against a volume striker, yes, you might get hit by a couple of shots, but they're probably not going to be hard enough to just end the fight immediately. So I do think Krylov can make a few mistakes in this matchup without paying dire consequences for them.
Matt, we have a look at the odds in this one. Krylov open minus 250, minus 190 right now. For Gustafsson open plus 170, plus 155 is comeback at the moment for Gustafsson. We have a look at Tapology, Matt. Surprise to us as it is to you. Gustafsson's a big fan favorite, UFC Hall of Famer. You better not be looking at the votes. Don't cheat. I'm going to say over, under, you are 65% Gustafsson.
He's so washed, though. I think it's going to be on. It'll be close to 50, I think.
It is. You cheated. 1,229 total votes, 53% Krylov, 54% by decision, 22% by submission, 16% by knockout. For the 47% that have Gustafsson, 66% by decision, 26% by knockout. I think if Gustafsson beats Krylov, it's probably by finish, which might sound odd. And I think if Krylov beats Gustafsson, yeah, it could be that lifesaver any which way. Let's just split it all the way across. But I do have Krylov, younger fighter, more active. Again, like if you want some more Apple Music playlist suggestions, hit me up, I guess. But Matt, I'll let you kind of take the torch on this one.
It's like the opposite of the Paul Craig effect. Like with Paul Craig, enough is enough. You got to respect the guy. For Alexander Gustafsson, when are you going to show me the old fighter that you once were? I just don't think he's there anymore. And you have to remember, he took a lot of time off after the Glover win and the John Jones loss because he was one of those like number one contender, like half number one contenders where he just sort of had to wait for the right opportunity to actually get that title shot. And he wasn't really the same fighter after he lost by TKO to Jones the second time around. Like Anthony Smith, that was a good fight that they had. He had Smith hurt to the body with a kick at one point in that fight, but still, when the going got tough, Anthony Smith was able to tough him out. And same thing with Fabricio Verdum. Like when the going got tough with Gustafsson, Daniel Cormier said this leading up to their fight, and I hated hearing it because I loved Gustafsson at the time, but that was his thing. He's like, when the going gets tough with Alexander Gustafsson, he's going to look for a way out, and I'm the king of the grind. Now, Gustafsson got really tough in that fight, and that's an all-time great fight between those two, but still, that was always a question mark with Gustafsson after the Rumble Johnson performance, and I just don't think he's going to go back to the fighter that he once was.
The Rex in my Apple Music, the last three artists I've listened to, Charles Wesley Godwin, some good music there. I like Hardwood Floors. I get the Payback by James Brown. And what about it? Let's go.
Wait,
I don't want to
wait. My last three. How do you go my last three and then go, what about it? You must have skipped something.
I had the artist. So I just had the artist in the album, but I don't want to wait the song by the War on Drugs. So Matt, we have a big time weekend of fights coming up. Both of us going with Nikita Krylov to get the win. It might not be popular. We have some big time fights left. Levitt, Pimblett. What about a co-main event between Chris Curtis, the Action Man, taking on Jack Hermanson, the Joker? And in the main event, Curtis Blaydes taking on Tom Aspinall. You're not going to want to miss it. So keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. And as we always say,
let's get into it.
Coming up this weekend at lightweight, this is a fight for the Underground Whisper Network of MMA. This is a fight for the hardcores. This is a fight for the English MMA fans. This is a fight for the Scousers, but also those of you in the Southern United States or the Southwest of the United States, I should say. We have Jordan Levitt taking on Paddy the Baddie Pimblett. Matt, so many people recognize Paddy Pimblett. He is out there for all the right reasons and all the weight gain reasons after he won his last fight. And if you look at it for Pimblett, he's hanging out at San Diego Padres games. He's making a name for himself over in North America. You look at it in the five on in, it's 4-1. He did lose that fight against Soren Bach back almost 4 years ago by decision. But since then, wins over Decky Dalton, David Martinez, a win over Luigi Ventramini, and one over Kazula Vargas. And those two fights in the UFC, he had to withstand quite a bit of adversity in both of them to lock up those wins. Obviously, his last time out against Kazula Vargas was 4 months ago when the UFC came to London at the O2. The last time Tom Aspinall was in that main event against Alexander Volkov and a slew of fighters that are on this card were on that card as well. But if you look at it for Jordan Levitt, he's an interesting case because he does have a nice five on in. He has that loss to Claudio Poyas, a fight that was very close and it did have a lot of back and forth in the UFC. Wild slam knockout over Matt Wyman almost 2 years ago. Kind of funny to think it was that long ago. The loss to Poyas, the inverted triangle win over Matt Sales, and then his win by split decision about 3 months ago against Trey Ogden. A lot of people on both sides of the fence on that one. But for a guy like Jordan Levitt, Matt, he is so good with his takedowns. He's so good at holding position. He's very much position over submission, though he has a lot of submission wins. But when you look at a guy like Jordan Levitt, it is, I'm going to grind on you. I'm going to take you down. I'm going to wear you down. And then I'm going to try and beat you. Whereas Paddy Pimblett is a much more dynamic fighter who will take a lot more liberties in his fights. And I haven't even mentioned their striking, which is polar opposite between these two guys.
And that's the thing about this matchup. Jordan Leavitt probably will not be able to take advantage of a lot of the holes that we have seen in Paddy Pimblett's game. Because for Paddy Pimblett, you're right. The highs have been very high in the UFC, but you're sweating if you've ever put money on Paddy Pimblett in the UFC up until this point. And the thing is, okay, you can be wild against a guy like Luigi Vendramini. You can be wild against a guy like Kazulu Vargas. But are they really the type of fighters who a top-level prospect should be beating? Like, yes, they are, and they're good wins. But that's why I'm really surprised with this matchup against Jordan Leavitt, because I think Leavitt is a very dangerous fight, especially for where the odds are. I'm sure we'll talk about that later. But Leavitt is another guy who's looking for that big win to help himself break through. And these guys are both, they're pushed, but in very different ways. Like, if you're a hardcore, you realize how good of a fighter Jordan Leavitt is and how good of a foundation he has for his MMA skill set. But the thing is, Paddy Pimblett is arguably the hottest star in the UFC. Like, Joe Musgrove knows who he is, and I doubt there's a lot of fighters in the UFC that Joe Musgrove's familiar with. So I think this is a much more dangerous fight than maybe even the UFC realizes, because in their mind, they're probably thinking, okay, Leavitt's not a great striker. He himself is a grappler. If Paddy Pimblett's going to outstrike anybody, it's going to be Jordan Leavitt, and then he could probably match him with his jiu-jitsu on the mat. So maybe the UFC is looking at this as an extremely favorable matchup for Paddy Pimblett. But in my mind, I really do think Jordan Leavitt's going to be able to cancel out a lot of the grappling of Paddy Pimblett. And we might just see Pimblett being, you know, kind of a volume striker on the outside. Maybe he has to be a little hesitant because he's worried about Leavitt's offensive takedown. I do think there's a world where this is a fight where both guys could lose quite a bit of stock, if I'm being honest.
It's a hard one. And I mean, if Joe Musgrove knows Paddy Pimblett, do you think that Mike Clevenger knows Matt Allen? Like, is that who you're modeling yourself after?
I mean, I'm getting pretty close to it.
Great. Yeah, I mean, non-baseball fans, we've lost them. If you're from the UK, I'll try and reel you back in, but there's no football players with my Tottenham Hotspur that have the hair, so I don't have a comparison there. But Matt, when I do look at this fight, you're right. I mean, Ricky Tercios left a bad taste in everybody's mouth. I went out there and said, this guy's going to have wild volume. Was I wrong? He threw incrementally more volume round by round at lower accuracy percentages as it went along. So I wasn't wrong with that, but yeah, Ricky Tercios, that's the trouble with Paddy Pimblett. Are you all the way in? Are you all the way out with your strikes? And how accurate can you be at getting through the guard? Because I say this every Jordan Leavitt fight, and it doesn't change. He's a syndicate guy. He blocks like this, and it's really weird, and it's hard to get around his guard to hit him. If Trey Ogden was the guy to do it, I thought he would have been the guy to do it. He wasn't really able to do it. For Jordan Leavitt, too, the blueprint's already out there. Soren Bach was able to take down and control Pimblett in set positions on the ground. Go back and watch that fight. That was the most amped I was for any Cage Warriors card. I watched all those sit-downs that they had in Liverpool. Like, it was such a big deal. And then Soren Bach was able to go out there and implement his wrestling game plan. Now, again, that was a few years ago, and it was down at, you know, in his hometown, and the pressure was different. But when I look at this one, blueprint's there for Jordan Leavitt. So it is a really tricky fight for Pimblett. Again, gets caught on the feet by Kazula Vargas, who wasn't supposed to be a tough challenge at all. Fights Luigi Vendramini, who, again, I, Craig Allen, hold in high regard, but a lot of people don't. So take that for what it's worth. But when you do look at this fight, Matt, you'd mention it. I mean, Paddy Pimblett opened a minus 400 favorite. He's a minus 262. Jordan Leavitt opened plus 330. He's a plus 209. We have a look at the Tapology votes. Paddy Pimblett, one of the brighter stars coming up in the UFC. I'm going to say over under 85% Pimblett.
It'll probably be over. It'll be somewhere in the 90s just because he is so popular globally.
All right, let's have a look. Oh, no. So it's under 1,221 total votes, 77% Pimblett, 24% by decision, 14% by submission, 55% by knockout. I mean, folks, Jordan Leavitt's lost one fight by decision. For Jordan Leavitt, 35% by decision, 46% by submission, 13% by knockout. So I'd be hella surprised if Paddy Pimblett knocked out Jordan Leavitt. Like, TKO due to ground strikes, maybe? I don't see where that one's coming from.
That's actually how the fight's going to go, if I'm being honest. Really? Here's the thing. We focused a lot about how Jordan Leavitt can cancel out the positives of Paddy Pimblett. Let's just call it how it is, though. Jordan Leavitt's probably not going to be able to out-grapple Paddy Pimblett for 15 minutes. That's how good of a grappler Pimblett is off his back. He's a much more dynamic guy with his submission ability. He is much more willing to take big risks. But the thing is, Pimblett is going to be the bigger fighter in this matchup. And I do think that's going to help him work out of some bad positions. Whereas for Jordan Leavitt, on the feet, he's very basic. And on the feet, Paddy Pimblett has got the respect of his opponents early on in his past fights. So I just don't think Levitt can hurt him the way that his past few opponents have been able to. So I think we're going to see Paddy Pimblett striking with reckless abandon because he knows, okay, if Levitt takes me down, he's not really necessarily the finisher that I am on the mat, although Levitt does have good submission abilities, don't get me wrong. I just don't think he's the level of grappler that Paddy Pimblett is, and I do think Pimblett's the much better striker. So I could see a world where he goes out there, just hits Jordan Levitt with a big blitz and finishes him early.
I think Paddy Pimblett can beat him on the feet. And that is the reason ultimately that I'm taking him. Now, I see more of a long game approach. Obviously, he was able to finish Luigi Vendramini. He finished Eki Dalton with those crown strikes as well in a different manner. But when I do look at this one again, Jordan Levitt, I go back in my mind. I think of that Soren Bach fight. I think of a guy in Levitt where once he gets that takedown, he really has good top pressure. He can hold a lot of his opponents down. And I said it earlier on in the card, Mandy Boom in a fight that most people are going to skip and just look at the prediction. And if Victoria Leonardo wins that fight, they get really upset because you guys didn't say anything about her. That's what happens every single week, folks. But when you do look at a matchup like this, I don't necessarily love a fighter off their back trying to fish for submissions because it doesn't always work. But with a guy like Paddy Pimblett, I like the complete game when I compare it to Jordan Levitt's. I think Levitt is so specialized in that one area. And he's not as well-rounded. So for me, I do like Pimblett in this matchup. But it should be a fun one to kind of set the table for the co-main and main event.
I'm just really curious when and who is going to be Paddy Pimblett's first, like, genuinely threatening opposition. Let's
Gregor just Gillespie.
That's not a fight the UFC wants to do. Gregor Gillespie, it's almost like if George St. Pierre won the middleweight title and left like he did. Like, if Gregor Gillespie beats Paddy Pimblett, Gregor doesn't then become a big star because he doesn't fight often enough.
He's a thief in the night.
He certainly is, but that's the thing. For Pimblett, at a certain point, he is going to have to fight somebody who either is a really big name, was a really big name, or is a talented enough fighter to where they can really pose an official threat to him. Maybe that's like a Jim Miller. Jim Miller's looked really good as of late. That's a fight that I'd really like to see, but that's the thing about Pimblett. You can be this really polarizing star outside of the cage, but at a certain point, it's your skills inside of the cage that are really going to sell the pay-per-views and get you a lot of the money. So for Pimblett, he will need to raise his level of competition at a certain point.
Both of us going with Liverpool's Paddy Pimblett in this matchup. And as I mentioned earlier, Jack Hermanson's taking on Chris Curtis next. And in the main event, Curtis Blaydes at Tom Aspinall. You are not going to want to miss it. So keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, as we always say.
Let's get into it.
And coming up this weekend, co-main event of UFC London. What a big time scrap in the middleweight division. Chris Curtis gets the opportunity of a lifetime to take on a top 10 ranked contender in the Joker, Jack Hermanson, representing Norway and Sweden equally. And Matt, for Chris Curtis, it's been a wild ride just in his overall career. He's had a couple of retirements. He won that fight against Sean Lally by knockout, spinning kick, doesn't get the contract. And it was a surprise to pretty well everyone. He's cut his teeth with PFL, with XMMA since. And inside of the UFC's octagon, you look at it for Chris Curtis, and I mean, it has been win after win after win. He knocks out Phil Haas in the first round of their fight, that debut back in November at UFC 268. He knocks out Brendan Allen at UFC 221 in a fight where Allen kind of jumped, got the back at one point, wasn't able to get the submission. And if you look at the finishing sequence that Curtis was able to get, it was absolutely amazing. His last time out, this will be his second fight in just under a month. He took on Rodolfo Vieira back on June 25th, picked up a hard-fought decision victory in that one, a lot of back and forth. Curtis looked really good on the feet, and now all of a sudden he's rewarded with this opportunity with Darren Till falling out of the matchup with Jack Hermanson. But Matt, we talked a lot about Jack Hermanson on this channel. He's been a fan favorite. He's been a Fight Night Pick fan favorite as well. You look at the overall career, he makes his debut years ago in 2016, win over Scott Ashcombe. And since then, it's been a lot more wins than it has been losses. You look at his last win back in, it was last May against Edmund Shahbazyan. He was able to mix it up. He was able to utilize his wrestling as well. But obviously, his last fight leaves a bit of a bad taste because he was kind of hesitant his last time out against Sean Strickland. And even if you look at his loss before that against Marvin Vettori, it was a fight of the night and they both threw a lot of volume and kind of canceled each other out. But it was Vettori able to get the win out there. So Matt, I do look at this fight, and for Chris Curtis, good defensive wrestling, good offensive wrestling, depends on the fight. Good power, good volume too. You look at it for Jack Hermanson, some of the same things can be said. I'm really eager to see what Curtis is able to bring out of Hermanson and vice versa in this one.
This will be a really interesting fight. It's a great opportunity for Chris Curtis, who really has been a company man since coming over to the UFC, because he really will take any fight at any weight class on pretty much any form of notice, which is a really nice thing to see for a guy who doesn't really have to, because he's Chris Curtis. Like, he's a guy who was known about before he came into the UFC. Everyone knows that story about him kind of retiring and then coming back, and now he's had the second sort of stint or second career resurgence, which has been really nice to see. But the thing is, you know, there's fighters in every top 15 who are kind of like the boogeyman. Like, Tony Ferguson was that for the longest time. Islam Makhachev was that for a long time. It's fighters who don't have big fan bases but are very dangerous fights, and that's why nobody wants to take them. Jack Hermanson, to me, feels like the complete opposite. I feel like guys are calling their managers left, right, and center to fight Jack Hermanson because he's got a big name. He sells well in Europe. He's a fighter who, if you beat him, only good things are going to happen to you for the rest of your career. So I really do think Chris Curtis has put himself in one of the best positions possible. It does kind of show that, like, hey, if you do the company a favor, they will reward you sometimes. I'm not always saying they do, because some fighters get screwed over and never get title shots. But it is nice to see them rewarding Chris Curtis with a huge opportunity, because let's be honest, he's got ready for Jack Hermanson in three straight UFC fights now. And that's got to give him a lot of confidence, because you look at how Phil Haas, Brennan Allen, and Adolfo Vieira all fight. They're all guys who are good grapplers who look for the takedown, but will play the striking game with you quite a bit throughout their fights. Sorry, let's do the Brian Windhorst. Now, why would they do that? Jack Hermanson is exactly like those other fighters that Chris Curtis has been getting ready for, and I do think that does have to be somewhat of an X factor going into this matchup, because Jack Hermanson is someone who, if he doesn't get the takedown early, he does become very uncomfortable on the feet. It makes the octagon so much smaller, because he realizes, hey, I'm kind of exposed now becoming a striker, and I can't go to the well, because we all know how good his grappling is. Like, his submissions are legit. He's got that weird outside-the-body guillotine that he likes going to. It's almost like the opposite of an arm-in guillotine. He does it from the opposite side. He's very unorthodox with his grappling game, but due to the fact that he is so uncomfortable on the feet, I do think there's a world out there where Chris Curtis defends a couple early takedowns similar to the Jared Cannonier fight, hits Jack Hermanson with some big shots, and then Jack Hermanson just starts going for some panic takedowns. And the thing is, when he goes for those panic takedowns, it makes him very susceptible to big shots from his opponent.
Yeah, and he's one of those guys that'll kind of go across the cage, arms out, like we saw, you know, our guy. He's a channel staple, Marcin Prachnio, hands down, walking across the cage, strutting stuff to Sam Alvey, gets knocked out, like, cold by a flush hook. Like, Jack Hermanson reaches out like Nosferatu, like he's just going out in the night, and then he's getting put out into the night. So I do look at it for Jack Hermanson. I'm going to flip it a different way. I look at the three losses that he has, his last three losses. One is Sean Strickland, which... Yeah, Sean Strickland got knocked out by Alex Pereira. We know this now. You look at the... You've muted yourself again, Matthew.
Here's the thing. You have called middleweight the weakest division in the UFC, and I do agree with that. So True. That's the thing. Sean Strickland, compared to an unranked fighter being the fourth-ranked fighter, is much closer to someone who's just breaking into the rankings than there would be in, like, the lightweight or featherweight division.
Loses that one by split decision. Loses a fight in the night against Marvin Vettori. Loses Jared Cannonier. He gets finished. Those are all five-round main events. And that Cannonier one was in Denmark, which was like a big hometown marquee somewhat for Jack Hermanson. And then I look at the wins that he's had. The Kelvin Gastelum one that he was able to get done really quickly. In or out Kelvin Gastelum about 2 years ago. The win over Edmund Shabazian. That was a co-main event of a big-time card. He's lost these big five-round fights. So in these three-round atmospheres, he shined. And you look at the matchup that he's supposed to have against Darren Till, a guy who's probably not going to take you down, if we're all being honest. He's going to want to strike with you. Chris Curtis is a guy that might try and take you down. He's going to want to strike with you. And again, it's a short-notice opportunity for Curtis, who made Rodolfo go 0 of 20 on takedown attempts just a month ago. So defending a lot of those opportunities. We have a look at the odds here. Hermanson open minus 160. The line popped way up. And it's gone back down. So minus 107 for Hermanson, minus 115 for Chris Curtis. Matt, we throw it on over to our community tab. Threw this one out there earlier on today. 870 votes, 69% Curtis, 31% Jack Hermanson. Curtis unranked, Hermanson number 8. Bob with the top comment. Each time Hermanson fights, my opinion of his abilities lowers. Has not made any noticeable improvements. Just do not care. Just do not hold him in high regard. Curtis also great at defending against grapplers. Really wild in 1 year. Chris Curtis will be a top 10 middleweight. Speaks to how weak middleweight is and speaks to what a gamer the Action Man is. Mark Mancini, big fan, guys. Curtis has the power and takedown defense demonstrated in the Vieira fight to beat Hermanson. Ben Elsom saying, love what I'm seeing from the Action Man, but not sure he has the one-punch power needed to stop a very durable Hermanson. I'm at one more from Matthew Moore, who says Jack should be able to take him down and control. Curtis has good sprawl takedown defense, used to fighting on short notice. I still give it to Jack. So, Matt, what's the overall takeaway? What's the pick here? You muted yourself. Come on.
I do think that there is an avenue for Jack Hermanson to win. Again, if he's able to go for that first takedown and force scrambles based off the first takedown, I do think that is going to open up an avenue for Chris Curtis to just be more in the defensive. And that's going to be the important thing, because for as long as these guys are on the feet, Jack Hermanson's legitimately going to be in danger. Like, I do not think he can strike with Chris Curtis whatsoever. And I do feel like his striking has almost devolved as his UFC career has progressed. And maybe that's just because there's more film out there on Jack Hermanson at this point. So guys can train a little bit better for him. They can have more specialized training to figure out what the holes in his overall game are. I just don't have a lot of confidence in Jack Hermanson at this stage of his career. You bring up how his losses are against some really good fighters, and I do agree with that. But boy, some of his wins age poorly. Like, Kelvin Gastelum's, what, 1-5 in his last six? That's not that great of a win.
He looked good against Ian Heinisch.
Edmund Shabazian is not that guy that we once thought he was. So it's just, for Jack Hermanson, you really got to go back to almost the Jacques Array win, and that was a meaningful period of time ago. So I think that there's a world out there where Hermanson is able to grapple his way to a victory, but I see a world where Chris Curtis doesn't get a knockout win, but he does dominate with his striking. I think he does have knockdown power. Whoever said that comment to where Chris Curtis might not be able to knock out Jack Hermanson, I agree 100%. I think he could hurt him early on, similar to how Marvin Vettori was able to, and then I think that's going to force Hermanson to fight in a much more reserved manner, and if that is the case, I do see Chris Curtis being able to win this fight by decision.
Rodolfo Vieira has good takedowns in the first round of his fights. And I've said this time and again, his double leg at the start of a fight is really good. You go 0 of 20 on takedowns, that's something to behold. Take that 0 of 20. Like, do you remember the end of that Chris Curtis, Rodolfo Vieira fight? Like, we're gasping for air and Rodolfo is just reaching for anything. And oh, there's another. Let's just tally that one up as a takedown that was defended. It's still credit to Chris Curtis. I know he's a fan of the show. I know he watches these videos, and I've been picking Chris Curtis in these fights. I'm not picking him in this fight, Matt. And again, three-round atmosphere for Jack Hermanson. Much better at the striking. You got to stop muting your mic. He's much better when it comes to, you know, figuring out these three-round puzzles. And again, getting ready for a fight against Darren Till, who's a primary striker, you have to think grappling's a big portion of Hermanson's game plan. I love Chris Curtis for his takedown defense. I love his takedowns that he was able to implement in his fight with the PFL against Andrea Fialho, a primary striker. But again, like, when it does come down to this one, I think Hermanson has it, and it really is a tough one to call. And again, Matt, our fans, they're so great out there. They're always filling out that YouTube community tab. 69% of them taking Chris Curtis to get the win. They also hit us up over on Instagram. You can find us at FightNatePicks over there. It's very simple. And 65% of them in that story have have Chris Curtis to get the win. So pretty well everybody's going with Curtis. Hermanson's a slight underdog. I have Hermanson in this one. If you can unmute yourself and let us know your final thoughts here, it would be much appreciated.
Here's the thing. I really like Chris Curtis in this matchup because, like I said, he's basically gotten ready for Jack Hermanson for a year and a half now. All of his training camps have been defend takedowns, force my opponent to become a striker because I'm the better striker than they are. And I do think that that's going to carry over into this fight. And the good thing about him coming into this on somewhat of short notice, because here's the thing. He was in great shape for the Rodolfo Vieira fight. We all saw that. Like, I honestly thought physically he matched up a lot better with Vieira than I expected him to going into that fight. And he didn't take any real damage. Yes, he was tired at the end of that fight, but it's not like he got dropped and he was really hurt at any point. So I do think Curtis is going to have a lot of carryover from his previous training camp going into this fight. And I do not like the progression that we've seen out of Jack Hermanson as of late. I don't think he is the same guy who went out there and looked really good against Jacques Array. Maybe he can prove me wrong, but he seems a lot older at 34 years of age to me than Chris Curtis does at 35, even though Chris Curtis almost retired once before. So Twice, exactly. So I think this is an incredible co-main event. Like, this is going to be a really fun fight because it's the unranked guy who has a lot of promise against the more proven fighter who hasn't been as great against the elite recently, which always makes for a really fun crossroads fight. But I do like Chris Curtis, the Action Man, in this matchup.
Big time opportunity for both guys. I'm going with Norway and Sweden's own Jack Hermanson to get the win. Matt going with the Action Man, Chris Curtis. Matt, 69% on YouTube, 65% on Instagram going with Chris Curtis. So I know I'm going to hear from the boo birds down below in the comment section, but let us know who you have and kind of expand on some of that reasoning for these picks. We absolutely love to hear from you and love to see that dialogue going on down in the comment section. Big time main event coming up. I mean, Curtis Blaydes and Tom Aspinall, top ranked heavyweights, a couple of guys really hitting their stride. You can't not get excited. You hate to use that, but you can't not get excited for this main event. You're going to want to keep it locked in with Fightin' Apex, as we always say.
Let's get into it.
In the main event coming up this weekend, UFC London, we have Curtis Razor Blaydes with one of the best walkouts in the entire damn sport. If you like Mortal Kombat, he walks out to the theme. He's going to be taking on England's own Tom Aspinall, a guy who's been a buzzsaw in this UFC heavyweight division. And if you look at it for Tom Aspinall, the wave of success, this is a guy that came into MMA as a pro in 2014. There were some hiatuses at certain points, but you look at it, wins a fight over Mikael Benhamouda back at Cage Warriors 107, 2019, debuts in the UFC in 2020, beats Jake Collier inside a round, beats Alain Badeau inside of a round, beats Andrei Arlovsky by rear naked choke, which never happens, back in 2021, wins over Sergey Spivak, and then a straight arm lock at 3 minutes and 45 seconds of the first round against Alexander Volkov back in March. His first main event was it for Aspinall in front of the O2 crowd, so he already has that experience this year. And he finished a fight inside of a round. He has looked amazing. We know how good his boxing is, his boxing combinations. For Aspinall, the hiatus, you might ask, well, Craig, why'd you talk about that? It's because Tom Aspinall was a main sparring partner of Tyson Fury to work his boxing. So for Tom Aspinall, the part that isn't talked about in his game is the fact that he has pretty good wrestling, but he's a jiu-jitsu coach at his father's gym. Like, jiu-jitsu is his first martial art, and we didn't really get to see it in some of those fights, but you look at it for Aspinall, gets it done, lights out on the feet, gets it done with his takedowns and his jiu-jitsu. Some people might go, well, Craig, he's got 100% takedown defense in the UFC. It's going to be cakewalk for him against Curtis Blaydes. He's defended 2 takedowns against Sergey Spivak. That equals 100%. So keep that one in mind. But Matt, for Curtis Blaydes, he was always viewed as this one-dimensional fighter, and his 3 UFC losses are to Francis Ngannou, and a fight against Derek Lewis that he was winning until that crazy uppercut knockout. But for Blaydes, his last 2 fights out, we've seen it. His fight against Jairzinho Rozenstruik, his fight against Chris Daukaus. I said this before the Daukaus fight. You dismissed me. You did. You poo-pooed the idea that Curtis Blaydes was improving with his striking. But we saw that. Curtis Blaydes against Chris Daukaus, when they went boxing for boxing,
he closed his eyes and threw a right hand.
We could stop it. We could see a progression from Curtis Blaydes, and we have seen his boxing really improve over at Factory X. I know some people are like, oh, well, he's training a little bit in Texas. He spent a week down in Texas kind of working on some things. But since he's moved to Factory X, you love some of the moves. He trains Thalister over him. But when it comes to a matchup like this, I think we have 2 guys that have different skill sets. They have similarities, and it makes for a very, very fun fight in this heavyweight division that we're always waiting on Stipe. We see him lifting weights at the fire station, and that's fun. We're waiting on Ngannou's knees to heal up. We're waiting on Cyril Gane to have his next main event. I think this is one of those fights that really fills that void and really gets people excited.
I feel terrible for Curtis Blaydes. Always the bridesmaid, never the bride. Like, he never got the chance. He had to fight Francis Ngannou, one of the scariest men in UFC history, one of the best heavyweights we've ever seen, gets knocked out twice. Okay, that's going to happen. Okay, wow, he's on a run again. He's going to fight Derek Lewis. He might actually get a title shot if he wins this. Gets flatlined in one of the worst knockout losses we've seen in recent memory. That's the problem with Curtis Blaydes. Yes, his striking has gotten slightly better. I'll give you that much. But this is my point about Curtis Blaydes and his striking. His wrestling is what opens up his striking so much. Chris Daukaus wasn't worried about the boxing of Curtis Blaydes as much as he was worried about the wrestling of Curtis Blaydes. That's why when Blaydes ducked and threw the right hand, it landed because Chris Daukaus expected a takedown off of that motion. So for Blaydes, yes, his boxing has got better, but I put it in the same category of like a Kamaru Usman. I still don't think Kamaru Usman's some great boxer on the outside, and I don't think Curtis Blaydes is either. I just think the threat of how good they are with their other martial arts does help them open up that one one area of their skill set. The interesting thing is, we've never seen anybody have success grappling against Curtis Blaydes in this division at all. Now, people have been able to defend some more of his attempts than they did in the past, because back in the day, it was, hey, it was like James Harden from the free throw line. He was going like 11 for 12. And it was really impressive, the wrestling output that Curtis Blaydes could do. Now we are starting to see a slight diminishment on just the percentages that he is able to secure some of these takedowns at. I always go back to the Jairzinho-Rosenstrike fight. Let's be honest. He didn't look great in that win. It was a good win over a talented guy, but Rosenstrike was able to defend a lot of those takedown attempts, and he did force Curtis Blaydes to become a striker throughout a lot of that fight. Now, to Blaydes' credit, he did enough with his cage control and with his overall forward motion to stifle the attack of Jairzinho. I just don't know if that's going to be enough against a guy like Tom Aspinall, who Jairzinho is one thing. Like, when he moves forward, when he's confident, he can have a lot of success, but there's big in-betweens in a Jairzinho fight. With Tom Aspinall, if there's an in-between, he's pumping the jab, he's going to the body, he's still making you think. And this is what I think sets Tom Aspinall apart from other heavyweights in this division. It's not that his hand speed or his boxing or his power is so great. Yes, that's true. It's very good. I just think he thinks the game as good as anybody in this division. Go back to that Volkov finish, how he got the takedown. He slips a front kick, knows that Volkov's going to plant off the front kick to throw the right hand just because it's a natural movement for him, immediately slips the right hand too because he realizes that that's the next part of Volkov's game, and then gets the trip takedown. That's what we talk about. Like, you can be a really good fighter from 15 to 5, but you have to be a really smart fighter to get from 5 to a title. And I do think that Tom Aspinall has been able to show the fight IQ that does make you think that one day he could fight for a championship.
That's it. Like, we talk about, you know, the Alexander Gustafsson fight, you know, how far is he into his career and what are we going to get this weekend? I don't know. You don't know. Nobody knows except for Gustafsson, I guess. But you look at him and then you look at Nikita Krylov. Nikita's got the striking. Nikita's got the submissions. But can he mix his martial arts? That's usually his problem. And that's where he gets caught in his losses. And that's where he gets his big wins. And he looks amazing in those fights. For Tom Aspinall, he mixes his martial arts like the best of them. And I know, guys, this sounds really simple and boiled down, but it is true. Watch Tom Aspinall when he fights. It's the fight IQ to have the submission defense if he needs it, which is very, very rare. The takedown defense when it comes to his fights outside of the UFC, because we've only seen it tested in one fight against Sergey Spivak, where that fight wasn't supposed to happen, and Sergey wilted under the pressure of the elbow and then the finish or the follow-up strikes. But when I do look at Curtis Blaydes, folks, he's 11-3 with a no contest in the UFC, knockout losses to Ngannou, and a hellish uppercut from Derek Lewis, a guy who has the most knockout wins in UFC heavyweight history.
And also, it's a no contest that me as a Canadian does not care about.
No, no. You can figure out if you can read between the lines what it was. But yeah, it was originally supposed to be Shamil Durkhimov in a fight against Tom Aspinall. Volkov gets that spot. It was originally supposed to be Sergey Pavlovich, and it ended up being Sergey Spivak. So what could have been? Again, I've been saying this for a long time, Matt, even since before Tom Aspinall fought against Jake Collier. I think Tom Aspinall is on a collision course for the top end of this division. I also think that if a guy known as Francis Ngannou wasn't in the UFC, there's a world where Curtis Blaydes is a champion. Like, it's not wild. And I know people will tee-hee and snicker about the Derek Lewis loss. The fight wouldn't have happened if he didn't have to fight, you know, Francis Ngannou. So revisionist MMA history, there was a show like that on this channel a long time ago, but I'm dead serious. Like, there is a world where Curtis Blaydes went all the way up to the title and he won it. Tom Aspinall, is he that next? We're going to find out. But we look at the odds in this fight, Matt. They opened a par. Curtis Blaydes, plus 110 underdog. Somewhere around minus 130 is Tom Aspinall. We threw it out there to the fans yesterday. 1,600 of you voted, so thank you so much. YouTube community tab, 72% Tom Aspinall. The best comments, Brandon Taylor says, LOL, Aspinall don't have Francis or Lewis power. He's going to get dominated. We have Bob saying there are close to no good heavyweights from England and even less good heavyweight grapplers for Tom to train with. I see him scrambling with some guys in full reptile, but I just feel him being open to grapple with Curtis is a recipe for disaster. Comically Insane says Blaydes better shock a lot of people. We have Artem Analysis saying, what would Aspinall do to Chris Daukaus? That's a good question. And we also have Refik saying Tom will win this. He's too fast for Curtis and too strong, not to mention 100% takedown defense. I saw this match for a while on the sports books, and I like Tom Aspinall. So going with that 100% number, thinking that's the big sexy, but you got to kind of reel that fish in and see what it is.
Here's the problem. I think Tom Aspinall is the more skilled fighter, but this is a very, very, very important X factor that I need people to listen to. he's from a country that doesn't wrestle, and he's fighting one of the best wrestlers in the heavyweight division's history. That really does matter. Like, that's the thing about fighters from London and the UK area. They have great boxing, they have great striking, but the thing is, they aren't taught wrestling like Americans are through their, like, school system, where Curtis Blaydes has been wrestling his whole entire life. And I know people like to look at Curtis Blaydes being a JUCO champion and try to use that as, like, a way to take away from his wrestling credentials. Like, John Jones was a JUCO champion too with his wrestling. Like, it does, you don't always have to be a Division One guy to have that level of success in the UFC. You can be a JUCO or a Division Three level wrestler. It just depends on how you translate your collegiate wrestling into your mixed martial arts style. And let's be honest, Curtis Blaydes is as good of a MMA wrestler as we have in the sport. And I do think Aspinall's really going to struggle with some of those takedown attempts from Curtis Blaydes. I am very curious, though, to see what Tom Aspinall's gas tank looks like if this fight does make it into the third, fourth, and fifth round. Because let's be honest, Blaydes doesn't look great as the fight goes on, but he has been in that position a few more times. I do worry about Blaydes' overall output with some of his own takedown attempts, though. Let's say he has good success with his takedowns in the first round, but round two, Aspinall defends a few early on. He gets taken down with like a minute left in the round. If Blaydes has used a lot of his energy output going for those takedowns, I do think there's a world where Aspinall can rally late, almost like Fazeev did against RDA. I know it's a little bit different because Fazeev was winning on the scorecards before the finish, but still, I do think the power of Aspinall could eventually get to Blaydes later in the fight, but that's the big difference. I do agree with our commenters. I don't think Aspinall is going to go in here and one-punch Curtis Blaydes. I do think it is going to have to be an accumulation of damage throughout the fight. It's just, it's really hard to accumulate damage against a guy like Curtis Blaydes, who is so dedicated to the wrestling game. If he does decide that's his game plan, we've seen Curtis Blaydes shoot for 20 takedowns in a fight before, and that's almost unheard of for a heavyweight in this division. So I'm almost reluctantly picking the underdog Curtis Blaydes, but I do think his wrestling is enough of an X factor for him to be able to get the win. It might not look pretty. It might not be what the fans want to hear or see, especially over in London, but I do think Curtis Blaydes is a uniquely poor matchup for Tom Aspinall.
It's funny, right? I mean, we've, you know, maybe intentionally, we've hyped up Tom Aspinall all this time. And we talked about his boxing. We talked about his takedowns. We talked about his defense. We talked about his jiu-jitsu. We talked about all the things that he has. And again, this contradicts everything I go with. I go with the well-rounded guy. Tom Aspinall is the well-rounded guy. He defended Sergey Spivak's reluctant two takedowns. That's a big thing, too. They weren't like Tom Aspinall taking on Jared Vandera with a chip on his shoulder. Like, this guy called me out. It was, I'm coming in on short notice. This is how I'm going to win. Oh, I didn't get them. Ugh. I like Curtis Blaydes in this matchup. You know, who beat Volkov more soundly? Well, one guy finished him in front of a hometown type of crowd. One guy took him down 14 times in five rounds. Tom Aspinall in his career, if I have anything positive, negative to say, I mean, Stuart Austin beat him, but that was 2015. Stuart Austin's got dusted in the PFL lately, so you can use that one for or against. But first round finish, got finished in the second round. But illegal elbow against, you know, wily European veteran Lukasz Porobiec. You go on anybody's record over there at 205 or 265. They fought him. First round finish against Collier, and then first. We haven't seen Aspinall in the second round, the third round, the fourth round, the fifth round in the UFC. I've seen Curtis Blaydes there. I know what the wrestling's like. I know what the cardio's like. I'm wondering what we're going to get because we're taping this on Monday. Curtis Blaydes posted that he's flying to London on Monday. So how will the time change affect him? So on and so forth. But I look at this fight. Yeah, Curtis Blaydes could get caught by a big shot. Tom Aspinall can throw big shots. Usually picks a guy apart and then starts to land his big shots off his accuracy. Really does a good job of throwing the L step, throwing movement at his opponent, and then really hitting them when it matters most. But I'm eager to see, because again, Aspinall, what are the get-ups going to look like? What are the submissions off his back going to look like? Can he get a key lock, or can he go Kimura to then get himself back up? Like, you know what I'm talking about? Some of these things that we do see fighters do, don't often see it at the heavyweight division. But yeah, I have Curtis Blaydes. I it sounds weird.
Here's the thing that I will say, though. If Tom Aspinall beats Curtis Blaydes, like, I won't pick him against him against anybody other than Francis Ngannou at that point. And that's me being completely honest. If he can go out there and, let's say, submits Curtis Blaydes like a rear naked choke. I know that's a wild thing to think about, but let's say hurts him on the feet. It's similar to the Arlovsky. Drops him, takes his back. There's a scramble, submits him. Then he beats Cyril Gane, probably. He beats Volkov again. Like, that's the type of fighter I do think Aspinall could be on his best day. I might be picking against him in this fight, but I'm almost rooting for him to get the win because I would love to see him fight Francis in the future. I think that'd be such a fun fight to see on the feet because, like you said, Tom Aspinall, a guy who used to train with Tyson Fury, Francis Ngannou might fight Tyson Fury in some strange exhibition mixed rules fight. So maybe there'd be a storyline there. It could be a fun one, but it's always nice to get new blood in the top kind of four of the division because it means that they could fight for the title. Hopefully Tom Aspinall is that kind of a talent. I just think Curtis Blaydes is such a unique puzzle for him to solve, and that's why I have to pick Blaydes.
75% of the fans on Tapology have Aspinall to get the win. Less votes than we had in the community tab. 74% by knockout for the 25% that have Blaydes, 50% by decision, 39% by knockout. So listen, Matt, the fans have Tom Aspinall. We're going with Curtis Blaydes, but it really is a tough one. I can't wait to do question mark kicks on Saturday because we're going to get the Boo Birds all throughout the week. I'll do the Hulk Hogan when he joined NWO with Scott Hall and Kevin Nash. Like, bring it on. Just don't throw garbage like they did at those guys and Mean Gene Okerlund, who was just trying to do a sensible interview when Hollywood Hulk took a turn. And when I do really focus in on this one, Matt, we're going to find out what happens Saturday. So it should be a lot of fun. If anything changes, you're going to stay updated here on the channel. You're going to have the individual videos, question mark kicks 2 hours before the prelims. And again, it's an early show on Saturday. It's been a rolling wave of success with Fight Night Picks the last 3 or 4 cards. It's been a lot of fun for us, Matt. So I know you're really looking forward to the fights this weekend.
Oh, yeah. We have another stack card. Good on the UFC. Like, you know the song Feels Like Summer by Childish Gambino? It feels like summer. It feels like summer when the UFC's throwing out good cards like this. I know July's that weird lull for a lot of sports because you really only have baseball regular season and that's it. Good on the UFC for filling this time with high quality fight cards because it could be the last pay-per-view that we had that was really good. The ABC card, of course, only the third one in history, but still they stacked that card. And for them to go back to London and give those fans another great card, just a really good sign because I know we were down on some of the fight nights that we were given earlier on in the year, but they have gone above and beyond this summer and putting together some really quality cards. So that's the thing. I'll call out the UFC when they give us a subpar product, but I'll also let them know when they give us a great fight card. And this weekend is one of those great fight cards.
And I've got the birthday pay-per-view card coming up on the next Saturday. You've got UFC 277. That one should be a lot of fun. So again, keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. And as we always say,
let's get into it.